Conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome to this Thursday evening edition of Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid. Glad you could drop by the palatial estate electronically for a little cussing and discussing this evening. Now, I assume that even as we speak, Barack Obama himself is speaking over in Beckley, West Virginia, which, if there is a God, he will not have referred to as Berkeley at any time during the speech. Sorry, I mean, these things do happen. And I'm hoping that we will have a call-in later in the program to discuss what was said. I have no idea what was said. I don't know if it's going to be a love letter to Cole or what. Because anything, you know, this is what, for Barack Obama to go to Beckley, West Virginia, is without a doubt one of those thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies kind of moments. Beckley is just chock-a-block with right-wing, dirt-ignorant, fundamentalist, creepy, crawly, cockroachy repig-lickens. No, I didn't go, Queen Esther. I wanted to be here behind the microphone. Queen Esther, that's good. Reference to Purim. And that's something I was just briefly chatting with Mark Levine about at the close of his program, and he says, "Yeah, Joe Lieberman, who has apparently become John McCain's keeper, had to correct John McCain again. Joe's running real hard for vice president, folks. I mean, you got to give the man some props, okay? I mean, he's running real hard for vice president." Sitting there, you know, sort of backing up John McCain when it appears that John McCain doesn't know the difference between a Shia and a Sunni, even though the difference has been pretty clearly drawn for, let me do the math real quick, 1,300 years. And thinks that Iran is training Al-Qaeda and yada, 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 Joe Lieberman. John. That's not how it is. Okay, that's not my best Lieberman, but I'll work on it. Listening to Joe Lieberman always reminds me of Pat Paulson. Looks a little like him, too. Has anybody ever seen him in the room at the same time? I don't know. Anyway, yesterday, John McCain goes to Jerusalem. And there was a photograph of him wearing the nice yarmulke. It was a good-looking yarmulke, too. It didn't look like anything plain. I mean, this one, you know, it was decorated nicely and everything. And he goes to the wall, the walls of the old... Yes, Mark. Yes. Lieberman is a nebbish. What's the line, Mark? When a nebbish enters the room, the wallpaper looks brighter. Yeah. Oh God, I love that stuff. Yeah, he's like, I don't know, is it an unfair conflation of two tongues to say that he's an uber nebbish? Anyway, McCain went to the old retaining wall of Herod's temple, and he had the yarmulke on, and I don't know if he put a prayer between the stones or whatever, or just said one silently to himself. But then he explained to the people of Israel what the holiday Purim means. Holy cow. He explained it as the Jewish Halloween. And I guess that means Halloween is, what, the Celtic... I don't know. I just don't know. But Purim, if I understand correctly, goes back to the time, and it's referenced in the Old Testament book of Esther. And that's probably unfair because it's the only testament in the Jewish faith. It's not like it's old. I mean, it's all old, but the new doesn't really count. But anyway, it's in the book of Esther, and it's all about how the vizier, Haman, right, was going to commit genocide against all of the Jews who were living in captivity in the Persian Empire under Xerxes the Great. And by virtue of intervention, the Jews get saved, and it gets transformed into a holy day of sorts. I mean, it's not High Holy Day, it's not Yom Kippur, it's not Passover. But I think it probably ranks. Yeah, what, Mark? You tell me. Is it kind of it runs kind of parallel in terms of importance, right there along with Hanukkah. And so that's a heck of a history. I mean, it's a bullet dodge, is what it is. It's another instance of the Jewish people dodging a bullet. And you know what? You've got a right to celebrate that. You get to celebrate when they try to wipe you out and don't get to. Yay, we're still here! And John McCain, in Jerusalem, explained to the assembled Jerusalem residents and various and sundry Israelis that holiday, that feast day that celebrates the not getting genocided again, is the equivalent of Halloween. I swear, how many times am I going to have to mention this? Yeah, I love this, Mark. Every Jewish holiday, they tried to kill us all, they failed, we eat. We have a nice dinner. How many times do I have to... If John McCain becomes the president of the United States, it will, I promise you, as sure as God made little green apples and they'll give you a bellyache, it will make George W. Bush look like a genius. I know, that just militates against everything that's going on inside your skull. Nothing could make George Bush look intelligent. You start watching John McCain. Well, I'm here to tell you that it's my understanding that this is your Halloween.
What does a Jewish witch look like anyway? And are there Jewish goblins?
Oh. And then Lieberman comes in and throws himself on his sword.
Well, I explained it to him poorly. It's my fault. That's the explanation that I gave him.
Oh. I'm proud of myself. I successfully inserted ELO's new video in my MySpace page. I think it's myspace.com/Bob Kincaid. The pastry sounds tasty. I like pastry.
I like money.
Line from Idiocracy, never mind. But I managed to successfully put ELO's video on my MySpace page, and I can't tell you how proud that makes me. I managed not to make it melt down, fall apart, explode, sicken my computer. Nothing. It just behaved itself. It read the code, and boom, the video's right there. There is hope for me, yet. So, in that video, she asks the question, are we ready to stop being idiots? And really, that's kind of, that's the referendum in November, isn't it? Are we ready to stop being idiots? Because if John McCain becomes the president of the United States, it's another confession. 2000 was a blip. 2000 was a mistake. 2000 was a screw-up. More people than not wanted to not be idiots and make Al Gore the president of the United States. It's just clear. There's no arguing about it. 2004, putting the little turd back in the punch bowl, namely George Bush. It's looking like maybe we're not so sharp anymore. In the year 2008 of the current era, if we elect John McCain, we can just roll Idiocracy as our national narrative. No longer will it be D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation and all of its slippery, slimy, inherent racism. No, our national narrative will be Idiocracy. Because John McCain, I promise you, and you know, I've gotten a track record for being pretty good with this stuff. And it's not anything, you know, call me now, I'll read your cards. See, I just stole that from Peter. It's not that. It's recognizing the consequences of actions and extrapolating them into the future. John McCain will make America look back in fond delight on the cognitive skills of George W. Bush. Because John McCain represents one of those sort of basic facts of royalty. Because he comes from kind of a royal American family. You know, granddaddy was an admiral, daddy was an admiral. John McCain couldn't get past captain. You know, that's kind of a mark of shame in a family like that. That was pointed out to me by a guy with some considerable knowledge, one of our listeners, our good buddy Tosh, with some knowledge of naval history and such as that. I mean, you come from a family that cranks out admirals and you can't make admiral? He graduated just like, very similar to George Armstrong Custer, at the very bottom of his Naval Academy class. And wound up being a not very good pilot at all.
And it's all because John McCain is not very intelligent. Had John McCain not married the heiress to a beer fortune, oh, you know, that's like the Flying Spaghetti Monster heaven. You know, when we members of the Pastafarian Church die and go to our reward, our heaven has strippers and beer. John McCain got his heaven on earth. He married the Budweiser distributor's daughter in Arizona and was taken under the wing of Charles Keating, who used, well, Charles Keating used John McCain like Elliot Spitzer used Kristen, okay? And John really didn't mind. And at no point in time has John McCain ever been called upon to exercise any particular brains. There's always been some lobbyist. There's always been some bagman. There's always been some somebody there to whisper in his ear like Joe Lieberman is now. And I promise you, John McCain, should he enter the White House in January 2009, will make us look fondly back at what will become referred to as the genius of George W. Bush. And I get some of this right from time to time. How long ago was it that I started mentioning the dichotomy between, say, Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, who were they're just plain crazy. Just, you know, sitting there after September the 11th, 2001, saying, God has withdrawn his veil of protection because we have homos and liberals here, and that's why God sent the planes into the buildings. I mean, I know it was at the beginning of this week. And I questioned why that wasn't mentioned side by side with Reverend Wright, and why John McCain seems to get a pass for his association with religious loonies, but Barack Obama does not. Well, I offer you a little snippet of audio from Stephen Colbert, and he had this to say on the 19th day of March, last night.
The controversy about Barack Obama's former pastor rages on, though not as much as his former pastor. And my guest, Dee Dee Myers, thinks women should rule the world. Let me guess, she's a woman. Hey, Stephen, don't forget to stop thinking out loud. This is the Colbert Report.
Oh, for heaven's sakes. Now we get the... I didn't know this. Now we get the commercial. It'll be here in a minute. But I want you to hear this, because I'm proud of myself when I get stuff right before others do.
I got to tell you, I'm sick at heart over the disturbing revelations about the newly installed New York governor, David Patterson. Evidently, he cheated on his wife as well.
Oh, screw it. Now, this is one of those cursed evenings. But the fact of the matter is, Colbert went on to mention the fact of, you know, exactly what I just was talking about early in the week. And Cenk Uygur, the Young Turk, I think there's only one Young Turk now. Cenk Uygur has posted something over at Huffington Post as of yesterday, again, several days after I brought it up, regarding right-wing preachers and the same accountability standard not being held against presidential candidates as Barack Obama was subjected to. So, I'm patting myself on the back a little bit. You hear that? That's patting. Patting myself on the back. Because I like getting it right before the big highfalutin boys do.
That's okay. All you got to do is look at it, and you'll figure it out. But just remember, when you're tuned in to the horn, it's like being in a time machine, and you're in the future while everybody else is still in the present. Coming up here a little bit in the program, we're going to have a conversation with a young blogger, J.W. Randolph. I think you'll like what J.W. has to say. J.W. is with Appalachian Voices, among other things. And we're going to talk a little bit about the two Democratic candidates and mountaintop removal and their positions thereupon. Right now, however, someone is blinking away on the telephone, and so we will go there, too. Hi, who have I got?
Susan.
What's up?
Well, I'm going to be rude, and I'm going to name the 900-pound gorilla that people don't seem to want to mention.
Yes.
When you go to the ballot box, people, ask yourself this. Are you going to want to vote for someone who, hey, I can't say for sure one way or the other, but are you willing to take the chance of voting for another man who may have Alzheimer's?
You think he's displaying symptoms, Susan?
Hell yes.
Okay, lay it out.
The whole thing with this flap, he's done it before. He's got a pattern of this forgetting things.
Okay, little evidence?
Oh, God. There was an article on the web of him. I'm going to have to dig it up and email it to you. But it was scary. And the first thing I thought of was Ronald Reagan. And
You don't think there's a risk of people of you don't think there's a risk of horn listeners voting for John McCain, do you, Susan?
No, what I'm saying is the possibility that somebody might be listening and somebody might say, hey, maybe we should check into this. Maybe we ought to ask him for his medical records.
Now, okay. I remember when Ronald Reagan promised to take some sort of mental acuity test, and if he failed it, he promised he would step down. Of course, he never did. Maybe it might be smart to get John McCain to take his on the front end.
Right.
You know, I guess the political wisdom would be that you can't do something like that because you'll piss off the single largest voting bloc, then single largest most dedicated voting bloc in America, namely, you know, older Americans, the people who really care about their right to vote, because they probably knew somebody who really fought and died or maybe fought themselves for that right in the Second World War.
But by the same token, they're also the people who are impacted most directly by that type of illness, and they know how devastating it can be. You don't want that type of person with their finger on the nuclear trigger.
No, I'm not suggesting that you do. I'm just wondering if it's a bit of a third rail, Susan.
Well, yeah. But it's something to think about.
I've been thinking about it. And I also think about it in terms of, let's face facts, there is a strong likelihood, at least in my mind, that whomever is his vice president will be the guy we wind up calling President so-and-so before the 4 years are out if the American people are outright stupid enough to vote for him.
Oh, Lord. Yeah. I don't want another Ronald Reagan. I've been there, done that, and really don't want to buy the T-shirt.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. The question, but look, I mean, we have to be members of the reality-based community, Susan.
Mm-hmm.
Alabama,
if this, you know, he's going to be the Republican nominee, so it's going to be either Obama or Clinton versus McCain. Alabama goes for McCain. Mississippi goes for McCain. Texas, like it or not, goes for McCain. Arkansas goes for McCain. I bet you Missouri goes for McCain. Kentucky goes for McCain. I think there's every likelihood in the world that West Virginia will go for McCain. It's going to be this. It's going to be the same old strategies all over again. And if the Democrats lose one of the big states that they've got to have, be it Ohio or Pennsylvania, or California, or Michigan, Wisconsin, Florida, Minnesota, one of those Iowa, got to hang on to its states. We lose it all. We've made this a lot as Democrats. We've made this a lot more difficult than it has to be by giving up on states. Now I know that the Obama people will tell me that but Obama won big and he did. And you have not begun to contemplate the dirty tricks that will be used in places like Alabama and Mississippi to make sure that the people who came out to vote for him don't get to do it in November.
I understand that.
So you see what I'm saying?
It's something that we need to get out there about McCain. It's something that needs to be gotten out there.
And I think it needs to be done tastefully. I think it needs to be done as gently as possible. But on the other hand, I'm not going to pull any punches in suggesting that the guy, Alzheimer's or no. I mean, Alzheimer's and McCain's like being behind 2 8-balls because he didn't have that much to work with in the first place. You know what I mean?
Yeah, ain't that the truth? Yeah, just a shake.
Not the sharpest knife in the drawer. In fact, he's such a he's not even a knife in the drawer. He's more like, the gravy ladle in the drawer. There's no edge on him.
Yeah.
He doesn't have an edge to be sharp.
Nope.
Exactly. Well, Susan, I got to run along because I've got to get JW on the line here.
You have a nice night.
And you too. And I'll, bear it in mind. Figure out what the easiest way to deal with this is.
I'll try.
Okay, thank you. Bye. See ya. Bye. And we'll take a little break and come back with J.W. Randolph. I think you'll enjoy the conversation a whole lot. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You're listening to The Horn. I'm Bob.
Well, I hear a great singing in these hills, in the night, the droning of his drills, with a hooty owl and a whippoorwill, like a nightjar without wings. I'm looking around me, it's so sad, the ravenous American dream gone mad. One guitar was all I had, and just one song to sing. And I would sing a song for mother, for the mother of us all. For are we all not brothers on this blue-green spinning ball? You know that mother loves you, lift your hands and your voices too. Let's sing a song for mother. It's the least that we can do. For oil's sake, we drill these holes. Her back is broken for its cold. Cash sugar rivers in for gold, with a crapshooter's lousy fair. But what about our future sons and daughters? Blood kin everyone. After mothers turned and gone, because nobody cares. Don't you turn your back on your mother, don't you look the other way. For everything that's broken, you know someone has to pay. You know that mother loves you, do what loving children do. Try and help save your mother, for her days are through. about your family and your family that is yet to be. There's plenty here for everyone, but not enough for greed. There's nothing new beneath the sun, only something's gone away. For everything her children won, why make mother pay? So let's give a gift to mother, so she'll know we really are the loving sons and daughters that she always knew we were. You know that mother loves you, and now it's time to show the love you hold for your mother before her time goes.
I could listen to that kind of stuff all night long and never get tired. Dobro in there, I think. Yeah. And slide action. Wow. That, by the way, is another tune from one of my favorite compilation discs called Moving Mountains from Falling Water Music. It was a benefit disc for the fight against mountaintop removal. On the line with us right now, as promised, J.W. Randolph. J.W. is a 24-year-old legislative associate with Appalachian Voices, and he's currently working to pass the Clean Water Protection Act. For those of you keeping score at home, the Clean Water Protection Act is H.R. 2169, and it's in the House. By the way, it's not the Clean Appalachian Water Protection Act. It's the Clean Water Protection Act, and supporting it will not only help end mountaintop removal, but it'll help protect the water where you live, too. So you get a double bonus of helping yourself and helping Appalachia at the same time when you call your elected representative and say, if I don't see your name on the Clean Water Protection Act real quick, well, I'm going to start talking about it to the people that I talk to when about who we're going to vote for, okay? What do you say? Think you can do that? Not real hard to do. Let's chat a little bit with JW. Hey JW, thanks for joining us and welcome to what I hope will be the first of many conversations here on the Horn.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much for having me, Bob.
It's nice to see somebody out there posting the kind of information that you are about the Democratic candidates. I read, well, frankly, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't have had the Hillary audio from her conversation with Beth Voorhees to run last night, and you did that via a blog post at the Appalachian Voices blog. Tell me if you don't mind, please, what's motivating your analysis here?
Listening to Beth was really interesting because we've had somewhat of a position statement from both of the other two front running candidates. John McCain told some of our members in New Hampshire, thank you so much, I'm going to stop the removal of the mountains. Barack Obama called strip mining an environmental disaster and says we have to find more environmentally sound ways of mining coal than simply blowing the tops off mountains. And then we had this analysis from Hillary where she says, I'm concerned about it for all the reasons people state, but I think it's a difficult question because of the conflict between economic and environmental trade-offs that you have. She says, maybe there's a way to recover those mountaintops once they've been stripped of coal, which if you've ever seen a mountaintop removal site, that's...
Yeah, this isn't like moving the London Bridge from London to Arizona with marked stones or anything.
No, it's exactly the opposite. So we're obviously disappointed in Senator Clinton's remarks. She sat in on hearings with mountaintop removal since 2002 in the Senate Environment Committee and, told us back then that she would take a flyover of the affected regions in West Virginia and has not followed through on that. So, her answer is disappointing, but also the fact that she claims ignorance is a little disappointing when mountaintop removal is an issue that's so important between West Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee and Virginia, And we're also, you know, she's setting up a false dichotomy between the environment and the economy. And this is something that we've seen throughout Appalachia, is in areas where you have higher strip mining, there's a higher correlation of poverty. So there's a high correlation between strip mining and poverty.
Yeah, so mountaintop removal doesn't bring jobs, it destroys jobs, right?
Mountaintop removal uses roughly 10% of the labor force. 50 years ago, when you were using traditional surface mining jobs, you may have sent, West Virginia may have sent 150,000 miners to work. Currently it's roughly 15,000 miners or less in West Virginia. So, and a lot of those traditional mining jobs now are lost, and it's actually heavy machinists doing the work. So, mountaintop removal is actually a net loss of jobs when we could be putting people back to work, providing energy with clean sources, with biomass, wind, solar, producing energy sources we can use annually.
Well, I don't know. This is a little bit off the beaten path, perhaps, JW. But just this past Monday and Tuesday, a couple of our hosts were at the Take Back America conference in Washington, D.C. And it was a fabulous gathering of progressives and liberals. And one of the people that they honored at that get-together was a woman, a dynamic, amazing woman by the name of Majora Carter. You ever heard of her?
You know, the name's familiar. I'm not familiar with the work.
She came back from college and went home to where she was raised in the South Bronx and started looking at industrial devastation there. And has started and decided that if nobody else was going to, that she would take it upon herself to start greening the South Bronx, and created a number of green jobs programs. The BEST, it's BEST, jobs training program, created an organization called Sustainable South Bronx, with the goal of providing people with sustainable jobs that paid well and would make for, you know, a decent living and a decent future for the people doing those jobs and for their children. It can be done. And, it can be done here in Appalachia, too, can't it?
Absolutely. And I think that there's a lot of pride taken here in Appalachia in providing America its energy. But we don't have to do that in a way that destroys our oldest mountains on the continent and that destroys over 1,200 miles of our watershed as of 2001. We don't have to do it in a way that poisons the water, and we can do it in clean, sustainable ways, like you said, and like Majora's done in the Bronx. And I believe she worked with Van Jones a little bit. I think I've heard him speak about that project. But we can absolutely provide energy in a way that is sustainable, that is clean, and that also allows us to bring in economic resources through our other economic engine, which is tourism. I went to school in Western North Carolina, and the economy down there is great and continually brings in a large amount of money through tourism, which brings people back year after year after year. And I think the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, that's the most visited park in the entire United States. Over 9 million visitors annually bring themselves, their families, and their money to that region. So this idea that mountaintop removal, you can either have a good economy or a clean environment is absolutely false. We can get rid of mountaintop removal on its own merits and still provide good, sustainable jobs to people in Appalachia.
But we have to start
America's energy.
But we also still have to talk about mountaintop removal in honest, realistic terms. And by that I mean we have to acknowledge that the reason mountaintop removal exists is not because it is a better way to mine coal, is not because it's a cleaner way to mine coal, is not because it is a less intrusive way to mine coal. The reason mountaintop removal exists is because it is the cheapest and dirtiest and fastest way to mine coal without regard to the environment and without regard to the region and things that you just mentioned, like tourism.
Exactly. And, the mountaintop removal is meant specifically to take the miner out of the mine and specifically to lower the coal company's overhead cost by removing labor and replacing that with replacing jobs with machines. And so we work on a bill in Congress called the Clean Water Protection Act, and the Clean Water Protection Act would not stop all mountaintop removal. But the Clean Water Protection Act would stop the dumping of the toxic waste from mountaintop removal sites in these large valley fill operations, which poison the streams that are in the river valleys. And so we had the EPA estimated in 2001 we'd buried 1,200 miles of our headwater streams. And then there's been 535 miles of streams are permitted to be buried since then. And so these areas not only serve, Appalachia and are destroying local well water sources, but they also serve the Great Lakes and the Chesapeake Bay and the Gulf of Mexico via the Mississippi River. I mean, the Appalachians serve as the major fountainhead for waters in the east.
The Big Coal River flows into the Kanawha. The Kanawha flows into the Ohio spills into the Mississippi, and the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. It's a big circle, isn't it?
It's quite a big circle, and we've had interest from legislators, both Democrat and Republican, from across the country, from California to Maine to Washington State to Florida, and even you go to the middle of the country, Kansas, Texas. These legislators are concerned about mountaintop removal. Kansas has a great thing going on. People love Kansas because it's flat. And, they want to keep their monopoly on flatness, I think.
Well, I just by virtue of some personal experience, I found out, for instance, that the entire congressional delegation of the state of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, almost said state, shame on me, Commonwealth of Massachusetts, they're signed on to the Clean Water Protection Act. That was a no-brainer.
All the legislators from Massachusetts, which are 10, I think we have the entire delegation of New Hampshire, and I think we've got 19 people from both parties in New York, 5 legislators from both parties in Pennsylvania, which is a coal state, several from Illinois, several from Kentucky and Tennessee, 3 from Virginia. There's a Chairman Bart Gordon, who chairs the Science Committee, represents Central Tennessee, and he has a lot of strip mining in his district and is a co-sponsor of this legislation, the Clean Water Protection Act, because he understands how valuable the water sources are in Central Tennessee, especially with the drought this year across the South.
And that brings me to another point, J.W. Now, North Carolina's got its fair share of Republicans, a few Democrats, and let's say Don Blankenship found a 3-inch seam of coal somewhere in western North Carolina and decided he wanted to start blowing him up some mountains, the people in North Carolina would almost consider that an act of war, wouldn't they?
Absolutely. And you see that with the congressional delegation. The newly elected Representative Heath Shuler, who represents most of Appalachian North Carolina, is dead opposed to mountaintop removal. He's dead opposed to liquid coal. I mean, he understands how economically beneficial the mountains can be when they're not destroyed, and from real estate to tourism and everything else, that's why people go to places like Western North Carolina, is to see and be in the mountains. And so if you went to Western North Carolina, people would be up in arms absolutely about this practice.
I was surprised to read a story a couple of weeks ago. The Tennessee legislative session was underway. And lo and behold, I'm used to looking at it through the lens of politics in West Virginia, J.W., and it's not comforting. But lo and behold, the Republican leader in the Tennessee State Senate was a co-sponsor of a bill that would outright outlaw mountaintop removal in the state of Tennessee.
Absolutely.
And that blew me away. I don't run around, and I'm not asking you to say anything partisan. I don't want you to. But I don't run around lauding Republicans. But this guy got it right. I don't know how many other things he gets wrong, but this one he got right.
Yep. And, so with the block of, any progress on mountaintop removal at the federal level, and in large part because Senator Byrd and Senator Rockefeller, Congressman Ray Hall, are supportive of mountaintop removal, and they're very powerful people in Washington, D.C. There's been inaction in Washington, and so what we've seen is people at the grassroots level in states that are being torn apart are taking action, and we've seen in the last year bills introduced to combat mountaintop removal, not only in Tennessee, but in Virginia.
Absolutely. John Blair Hunter's Senate Bill 588, which, of course, was promptly taken out behind the barn and shot. But the effort was made. I guess my question... Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, and the other thing was that we had, in Kentucky, this was one of the most amazing grassroots expressions I've ever seen. 1,200 people went to the state capitol in Frankfort to lobby for the Stream Saver Bill, which is, would have roughly the same impact as the Clean Water Protection Act. And so you've seen this groundswell of support across the states, in Virginia as well. It's people are really frustrated with the inability of the federal government to stop the practice and are taking it into their own hands in the states.
Everywhere except here. I mean, I appreciate what John Blair Hunter did, but we've got to also recognize the political power that is wielded here, Democrat or Republican, either way. There's a lot of power in Jay Rockefeller and a lot of power in Robert Byrd and in Nick Rahal and Alan Mollahan and heaven knows Shelley Moore Capito. And those people exert tremendous political pressure from the top down on the political machines at the state level. And I guess one of the questions I would ask you, given your position as a legislative assistant there with Appalachian Voices, how do the grassroots put pressure, how do we create the bottom-up pressure, if you will, to combat that political arm-twisting that goes on?
I think that all the seeds are there. A lot of my kind of very personal heroes, people that I saw working on mountaintop removal from when I was in school many years ago, your Judy Bonds and your Larry Gibsons, your Maria Ganos, those people are real heroes to me, and it really created a stir in their communities and also throughout the country, of course. But, I think that the Senate bill was a great vehicle to rally around for people. Polls have shown us that the majority of West Virginians oppose mountaintop removal.
Yeah, in excess of 70%.
And so having a good legislative vehicle like Senate Bill 588 is a great thing to rally people around. And I also think that people like Senator Byrd and Nick Rahal, not only need to be approached from every angle by people they know and trust and say, we can do better than mountaintop removal. We can only blow up our mountains and burn that coal one time. Need to start looking at the legacies that they're leaving for their districts and their states. I mean, you have areas, that have been completely obliterated.
Sure. I mean, most of this audience has seen the pictures. Some of them have actually seen it for themselves firsthand. You bring me back to the issue of sustainability, JW. Given your position with Appalachian Voices, you might know this considerably or have a greater awareness of this than me. Are there movements out there to prove that we can replace those so-called good demolition jobs with good sustainable green jobs in a place like West Virginia? Is there anything out there to show that it is viable?
Absolutely. Several people who I've worked with throughout the years, people like Stephen Rousseau and Rory McElmoyle, have gone to West Virginia to start doing exactly that. They're people who love the mountains and are working with local communities to come up with viable alternatives, such as the Coal River Mountain Wind Project, and that's on a very local scale. And then the grassroots groups several of us are part of an organization called the Alliance for Appalachia, which is an organization of 13 different grassroots groups across the Appalachian region. And we are also making it a major focus to look at how we can transition from this sort of mono economy of coal into a sustainable, diversified economy that has good green jobs and is more sustainable than a mountaintop removal economy. So, over the last couple of years, that kind of economic transfer was the thing that always got 5 minutes at the last of every meeting. But I think that that's really starting to take a central role as we see an end to mountaintop removal and sort of a light at the end of the tunnel politically with mountaintop removal well, as we've got three candidates who, you know, at least will be friendlier on mountaintop removal than the Bush administration, which is not saying a lot.
Well, it's a question of scale, isn't it? I mean, as noted, Barack Obama is or was speaking in Beckley as this show began, and I'm itching to know what he had to say. I'm itching to know if he had the courage to go into the belly of the beast and talk some reality to people there, because
I'm right there with you.
Beckley's a tough place to go for a Democrat, because these are people who believe that Osama's going to slit their throats in the middle of the night. The diehard so-called social conservatives, people who hate other people for how they have sex, people who hate other people for what color their skin is. You know, that's just Beckley up and down, in many, many ways. There are good progressive people there too, but they're frequently shouted down and drowned out. The newspaper is conservative. The radio station is controlled by conservatives and right wingers. I'm asking you to speculate here. Do you dare hope that Obama had anything realistic to say about mountaintop removal there?
You know, based on his statements before and his actions, such as, I mean, he talked about mountaintop removal at a speech in Lexington last August, and he spoke out against mountaintop removal in D.C. and as strong a terms as he could have, and it's mountaintop. His opposition to mountaintop removal is not in his energy platform where we'd like to see it on record. His support for the Clean Water Protection Act is not in his energy platform, and he's not spoken about that in his speeches. So, we would really like to see him, do those things. Speak against mountaintop removal in his stump speeches in much stronger terms. Include his support for the Clean Water Protection Act. And that goes for all the candidates as well.
See, something came across my radar a couple of weeks ago that just bugged the dickens out of me, JW, and that was prior to the Ohio primary. Are you familiar? You may or may not be familiar with this, but he was Senator Obama was being squired about by Jay Rockefeller. Why Jay Rockefeller was squiring him in Ohio, I will never know. But in the course of being squired about by Rockefeller, Senator Obama said something to the effect, it's a direct quote, that he wanted to turn Appalachia into the Saudi Arabia of coal. And that made chills run down my spine.
He's used the Saudi Arabia of coal line several times, and, I think that...
Has anybody pressed him on it to find out what the heck that means?
I'm not sure that people do know what it means. The best refutation of that statistic I've seen is in Jeff Goodell's book, Big Coal. He talks about the studies from the early 20th century that the number is based on, when most estimates give us roughly 100 years of recoverable coal in America. And Appalachia, the United States Geological Survey said in 2001 that Appalachia had 10 to 20 years of high-quality, high-bituminous coal left. I mean, we're past peak coal in Appalachia.
Well, wait a minute, okay? I'm not trying to be rude here, but if I turn on the radio, there's some ad from Walker Machinery or the West Virginia Coal Association that says there's 500 years of coal in West Virginia's mountains. And
President Bush says so.
It must be. Yeah. So I mean, that's not quibbling over decimal points. 500 years versus 20 years. Whose science do you think is better?
I think that science is better, and what the best science is telling us shows that Appalachia especially has nowhere near that much coal left at all, especially that's economically recoverable. You know, there may be 2-inch seams 2,000 feet below the surface, but, I don't know that we've got a straw that big or that much explosive that we could get it out with. So, you can't necessarily mine a seam like that and turn a profit. A lot of the seams that they're talking about and a lot of the coal reserves that they're talking about is out west, Powder River Basin in Wyoming. I mean, they do have reserves out there that will last longer. However, I've also seen people argue that even the Powder River Basin in the west has arguably reached their peak production as well. And you can look at returns from Appalachia over the last few years to see that, you know, our coal production has declined as well.
That's one of the things that scares me, JW, is that coal companies are not exactly well known for taking care of the communities once the coal plays out. And if, in fact, the numbers are 10 to 20 years, West Virginia is on the verge of facing a very, very harsh reality, whether it's a matter of them packing up and leaving, or I guess what I'm saying, there's going to be an end to mountaintop removal, because they're going to wind out, they're going to run out of mountains to remove the tops of
within our lifetimes.
And what happens when that happens? I mean, is the coal company going to take its profits and say, well, you know, we destroyed your communities, and here we want to retrain you now? I don't think so.
And I think that they've got a record that shows that. And so that's why what we'd like to see is, especially with presidential candidates, putting the horse out in front of the cart and preempting the end of mountaintop removal by necessity, and using the end of mountaintop removal, you know, with a few years buffer that we have, as an opportunity to really lift Appalachia up and make the Appalachian states the centerpiece of renewable energy in America, and to be able to turn us into, you know, we like to retain our status as America's engine. I think that people take it as a point of patriotism that we create a lot of America's electricity, and we can continue to do that in a sustainable way. So any mountaintop removal is good on its own merits, but we can really use this as an opportunity to revitalize our region in a sustainable way.
How do we get through, and this is kind of an ancillary question, but how do we get through to these people, for instance, these AstroTurf groups like in Greenbrier County that say that their viewscape is being polluted because of some windmills that they can't even see? How do we communicate? How do we make them aware of just how wrong-headed they are?
Well, I tell you, a group of folks from West Virginia just went up to Massachusetts to speak with some people about Cape Wind. That's the controversial project, because it's this place with great wind potential off the coast of Massachusetts, but it's in the viewshed of the Kennedy family, who, is our great environmentalists, and love them, of course, but they've opposed this wind project. And so people from West Virginia went all the way up to Massachusetts and said, hi, you know, we came all the way up here to tell you that, yes, this may be in your viewshed, but here's what they're doing to our homes. And I think that it had a real impact on the people in Massachusetts. And we saw several, national media outlets pick up on that, and the fact that people came from West Virginia to talk about that. So, unfortunately, Bob, I think it will be a long dialogue, and there's no silver bullet that will get that across. But the more that we talk to people, the more we show people mountaintop removal, the more that we have politicians not, you know, hiding from mountaintop removal or promoting it, but leading us in new economic ways.
Now, Appalachian Voices isn't just mountaintop removal, though. Tell folks a little bit, please, JW, about the overall work that you do.
Gladly. We Appalachian Voices does our best to tackle the problems. To tackle the issues that are causing people the most problems in central and southern Appalachians. And so, we have three major planks of our program. The first is mountaintop removal, we do work on the Hill, and we've done work with Google Earth, and IsleOfMountains.org on those projects there. We also work on clean air, so that includes working to protect communities where energy companies want to come in and build dirty coal-fired power plants. In particular, we're working on a campaign right now in Wise County, Virginia. Wise County has been 25% strip mined and mountaintop removal mined, and is up to a third permitted to be destroyed by those practices, and they want to put a new coal-fired power plant 4 miles away from another one and just right down the road from a school. And so obviously the people in the community are getting upset, and we've seen actually statewide organization to stop the Wise County plant in Virginia this year. It's been really, really exciting for us, and we just opened the Virginia office last fall in Charlottesville. And the last plank of things that we work on is kind of a renewable energies and healthy communities. And so that plank is changing over from forestry, which I think will still include some of our forestry work there as well. But, you know, that's changing and evolving as we look to the future and how we hope to play a role in Appalachia after mountaintop removal.
Do you have any kind of a focus or any kind of a position or any kind of thinking on Appalachian culture itself and its preservation from, you know, I mean, from food culture to music culture to storytelling or any of that kind of stuff, the sort of underpinnings of what it means to be an Appalachian person?
I mean, that's a big personal fascination to me and something that we write about all the time in a magazine that we put out six times a year called the Appalachian Voice. And it has a lot of information from, you know, from community stores and local music to, you know, ecological studies on rare and endangered species in certain communities. And but that does deal more with kind of the human culture side. So, yeah, it's, and you know, there's a good friend of mine named Jeff Biggers. And
oh, Jeff's a friend of mine too. So, yeah.
And we always call him the Appalachian Evangelist. And
oh, that's a great name.
You know, he's the original Appalachian Evangelist, and he's got a great book called The United States of Appalachia, where he talks about the progressive history of Appalachia and its contribution to the United States. It's called The United States of Appalachia, and I would really recommend that folks, especially folks who are interested in the progressive history of Appalachia and Appalachian culture.
I've argued that it should be on the shelf of every high school library in this country. Because it,
absolutely.
I thought I was fairly educated about our history, but Jeff just did wonders in opening other doors for me, and in fact he was the one who put me onto you, to be honest. Jeff's a great friend of the program, and I love all of his writing. He's my favorite travel and culture writer. I mean, I was thinking about that earlier today. That's the best way I can describe Jeff. And I'm glad to know that Appalachian Voices has an interest in that aspect of it, because that's, at the end of the day, that's a whole lot of what we're trying to save by trying to stop mountaintop removal. You can't have Appalachian culture without Appalachian mountains, can you?
Exactly. And look at the last chapter of Jeff's book. It closes with kind of this giant specter of mountaintop removal looming over Appalachian culture. And, you know, you can't, at this point in history, you can't separate mountaintop removal and Appalachian culture. And I think a lot of the Appalachian icons right now in the United States are people who are working to fight mountaintop removal. I mean, look at your Judy Bonds and your Larry Gibsons and your Maria Ganos and people like Wendell Berry. And these people are the people who are standing. This is where their time and energy is going, is because mountaintop removal is the biggest threat to Appalachian culture, you know, that we currently see. And so,
and the stuff that it brings with it. You know, we usually speak of mountaintop. And am I taking up too much of your time, JW?
No, not at all.
Okay, just a couple more remarks, a couple more thoughts. We tend to think about and talk about and visualize and image mountaintop removal in terms of what happens to the mountains themselves. But there's so much more. When you consider issues of soil erosion, of deforestation, of the and whether it's a valley fill covering up a stream, or just fill dirt that eventually drifts into the larger arteries, the silting up of rivers, we're talking about a process that could eventually wind up in pure and no uncertain terms being toxic to human life being able to continue here, aren't we?
It's already happening. Look at, if you go to ilovemountains.org, there's a photo gallery. And you can go to the photo gallery and click on maps of the mountaintop removal region. And you can go and see very clearly in Google Earth a map of population change and strip mining. And you can look across Appalachia and, you know, you look across West Virginia and Virginia and Kentucky and Tennessee and Ohio, and you look at the areas that are being heavily strip mined, and the population is out of there. I mean, these are not areas that people want to come into. These are populated. These are areas that are being depopulated.
It's ethnic cleansing of its sort, is it not?
You know, it's people cleansing or whatever it is. They're getting rid of folks. That's undeniable.
My family has been around here for in another 35 years, it'll be 300 years. We've been basically in the same area, and this is not an area that would be recognizable to the first people who came here, from deforestation to the elimination of the great temperate hardwood forest to the degradation of the waters. What do you guys prognosticate at all about what Appalachia looks like in 100 years?
Well, you know, I mean, to us, Appalachia, and I'm sure to you and your family as well, is the most beautiful place in the world. It is not a national sacrifice zone. It is not and should never be a resource colony for the United States, where people here can have poisoned water and have their tap water running black and have nobody pay attention. You know, the Appalachian Mountains are some of the most wonderful terrain in the entire country and filled with the most wonderful people. You know, I've been really fortunate enough to be able to travel a lot of the country, and whether you go see the Rockies or the Pacific Northwest or, you know, the Pacific Coast or even the extensions of the Appalachian Mountains throughout New England, you know, there's always a sense of home when you cross back into these mountains. And, you know, I think that's irreplaceable for all of us. And so,
you know what, when you meet a former Appalachian who lives out in flatland, they've got a strange look about them. I don't care if they're gone for 50 years, they're still looking for the mountains on the horizon that aren't there. I know this to be a fact because my mom and dad left here and moved to northwest Alabama, which is the last little foothills of the Appalachians. But I remember as a child coming here on vacation, and we would cross into West Virginia down at, crossing the Big Sandy on I-64. And the minute we crossed the West Virginia state line, my mother would begin to sing the state song. And it always sent chills up my spine. And it's only as I've become an adult and a parent in my own right that I understand why she was singing. Because coming back here means something more than coming back to just any old place you're from. There's a sense of rootedness here that I don't think I don't, and I'm biased, is hard to replicate in a lot of other places. So, you know, the work that y'all are doing, how many people are involved with Appalachian Voices?
Oh goodness, with the issue of mountaintop removal having such a gaining so much national attention, we've been adding several staff throughout the last year or two. I want to say we're roughly a dozen, but I can't keep up these days, to be honest.
So you've got you've opened a new office in Virginia, you've got offices in North Carolina. Where all are you located?
Our central office is in Boone, North Carolina, and we also have an Asheville office. Like I said, we just opened up the Charlottesville, Virginia office last year, and we also just opened up our Washington, D.C. office last year.
That's very interesting because Charlottesville, Virginia is the home of the corporation that's presently, without a permit, I might add, blasting the daylights out of the mountain that's 2 miles from me. Our windows shake about 3, 4, 5 times a day as the charges go off. And, I'm so glad that you're there because it gives me a sense of hope. You know, I'm talking to you right now, J.W., from the heart and soul of the tourism industry in West Virginia, the Whitewater Rafting area. And it's very frustrating because people from this area have tried to meet with the tourism companies, and they've said, well, we don't care. We're not going to take a position in this. We get a lot of good business from the coal companies. And the mountaintop removal job that I just referred to, on one side of it, the outflow is into the Gauley River, and on the other side of it, the outflow is straight into the New River. You know, less than a mile. Two, maybe 3 miles tops. And it's tough to light a fire under these folks.
Charlottesville office is a really wonderful fella and a new father named Tom Cormans, and he is a former raft guide on the New River. And he said he was a raft guide, and then he went and got his law degree from UCLA. And he said nothing ever made him fall in love with Appalachia so much as being in Southern California. So.
Well, there you go. There you go.
I think he shares a lot of your experiences there and love for that place. And I'm sure he'd love to go and meet with whichever.
Well, I tell you what. I will email you off air. And if you'd give me his contact info, I'll get in touch with him directly.
That's great. He'd love to hear from you.
Well, JW, thank you for the time that you've given us this evening. We really, really do appreciate it. And thank you for the skull sweat that you apply to these issues. And I hope that you and the rest of us involved in this fight are somehow able to get through to the senators and make them understand that it's not fair to sacrifice Appalachia on the altar of a national energy addiction.
That's right, and you know we don't quit fighting this thing at 5 o'clock. We're doing this with our whole hearts and our whole lives too. So, you know, we'll be out here and keep up your good work as well.
Thank you, JW. You take care.
You got to have a great day.
You too. Bye bye. JW Randolph from Appalachian Voices, appvoices.org. There's a blog there where JW posts quite frequently. And I think you would find his writing very, very interesting. So we'll take a little break for the top of the hour and come back with more other stuff. Whatever you might care to discuss, that's the meaning of conversation radio, isn't it? This is The Horn. Me, I'm Bob.
Trains run through our veins, moving monuments to better days. That mountain stands over our darkened lungs. It's time to ponder what we've become. In his company town, it's what we know. Change comes hard, change comes slow. Until the bottom falls out, that's how it goes down. Until the money's all drained from a company town. Yankee bosses worked us so hard for their well-dressed children and their well-kept yards. While coal camps echoed with the mournful sounds of impoverished voices from deep in the ground. Under this company town, it's what we know. Change comes hard, change comes slow. Until the bottom falls out, that's how it goes down. Until the money's all drained from a company town. Memories of World War II. Minds worked round the clock was the American thing to do. Families gathered round their radios to hear FDR say we'd make it somehow in our town. Shaft of morning light on jobless faces and their grim plight, while four men and a drag line blow the mountaintop off to take its heart out. Now it knows what we've lost in this company town. It's what we know. Change comes hard, change comes slow. Until the bottom falls out, that's how it goes down. Until the money's all drained from the company town. Until the life's all drained out of the company town.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
A little bit of downtime to try to find out what I could about what's going on with Barack Obama in West Virginia. Not a lot of information forthcoming. He stopped. I'll tell you what, you can't stop the Johnny on the spot, can't get nothing past him journalists. The big news, Barack Obama stopped in Charleston for lunch to have some wings and watch a little basketball at a sports bar over on the Kanawha City side of Charleston, where he was asked a question about the Michigan primary by someone who was apparently a transplanted Michigander. I frankly, you know, okay, so what? But no, he has said, however, in a speech at an invited crowd, by the way, you know, the us hoi polloi, we couldn't just show up for it. It was an invitation-only event at the University of Charleston today. He said that McCain would carry out a third Bush term and lashed out at the poisonous effects of the Iraqupation in terms of what it has done to the American economy. This is a quote from Senator Obama. When you're spending over $50 to fill up your car because the price of oil... Senator? Whole bunch of people in West Virginia drive pickup trucks that have 30-gallon tanks, baby. When you're spending over $100 to fill up your truck, that's, you know, a cultural thing. When you're spending over $50 to fill up your car because the price of oil is four times what it was before Iraq, you're paying a price for this war. When Iraq is costing each household about $100 a month, you're paying a price for this war, he said to the invitation-only crowd at... It says... I don't know what the hell, where the hell this reporter was. This is NBC reporter Aswini Anburjan. He thinks he was at the University of West Virginia in Charleston. I've been all over Charleston. Now, there is the WVU Medical Center Charleston campus, and there is the University of Charleston. And there is a University of West Virginia system, but that's largely just a bunch of trustees.
I don't know where this dude was. Dude being the reporter who wrote University of West Virginia in Charleston. Like I said, you know, I'll see Dateline Berkeley here in another couple of hours. Aswini Amberjam says that the speech followed one he gave yesterday, he being Obama, in North Carolina, where Obama argued that the war had strategically damaged the United States. In today's speech, he hit McCain early and often in his speech, saying that his call to renew the Bush tax cuts during wartime was irresponsible. Quote, John McCain once opposed these tax cuts. He rightly called them unfair and fiscally irresponsible, but now he's done an about-face and wants to make them permanent, just like he wants a permanent occupation in Iraq. No matter what the cost, no matter what the consequences, John McCain seems determined to carry out a third Bush term. Strong medicine. The Bush-McCain policies had ballooned the national debt, he said. Instead of offering an exit strategy for Iraq, he's offering us a 100-year occupation. Instead of offering an economic plan that works for working Americans, he's supporting tax cuts for the wealthiest among us who don't need them and aren't asking for them. And, of course, the John McCain camp responded,
"Today, Senator Obama once again displayed how fundamentally wrong he is on the central issues facing America's future, our economy and national security. On the economy, Senator Obama offers the tired tax and spend ideas of the past."
Just once, I'd like to hear some filthy freaking Republican offer something besides the same old tired slogans of the past. Too much to ask for, though, obviously.
On national security, Senator Obama would rather rehash the past than look forward with resolve to address fundamental challenges and opportunities we have today to secure our future.
Okie doke. These are the words of Jill Hazelbaker, the McSame communications director. What opportunities, Jill, baby? Name one. What opportunity do we have in Iraq?
Why, that's right, Jill. Honey, we've got opportunities in Iraq to get more Americans dead. Oh, yes, let's embrace that, Jill.
He has embraced an irresponsible policy of withdrawing our troops from Iraq without regard for the conditions on the ground.
I think Senator Obama's got a pretty good grasp of the conditions on the ground. I'm pretty sure, I can say with certainty that Senator Obama knows the difference between a Shia and a Sunni, you stupid twit! In a race where the Democratic nomination is still up for grabs, the lack of references to Hillary Clinton was notable. While Obama mentioned McCain 8 times, he only made 1 cursory reference to Clinton, talking about her own criticism of McCain for supporting the policies that have led to our enormous war costs. And then he said, but her point would have been more compelling had she not joined Senator McCain in making the tragically ill-considered decision to vote for the Iraq War in the first place. At the invitation-only event that us hoi polloi couldn't attend, Senator Jay Rockefeller introduced Senator Obama and told the crowd that he knew from Republican chatter, quote, "I know that the one person that John McCain does not want to run against is Barack Obama." Our governor, Joe Manchin, was also there. He introduced, he's a fence straddler, Joe is, he introduced Obama because earlier in the week he also introduced Hillary Clinton. He has remained neutral, he is riding in the middle of the road, and has not endorsed either candidate. Sometimes you gotta stand for something. But then again, somewhere deep down, Joe is wondering if maybe he might yet get to be Vice President, Joe Manchin. This also coming out from Rasmussen reports, Hillary Clinton has a strong lead in West Virginia for the primary. Rasmussen
polling shows Clinton with 55% to 27% for Barack Obama, and 18% of likely voters are undecided. You know, I bet you a bunch of my mountaintop removal opposition friends are in that 18% because we're waiting to see if one of them will just get all factual and tell the truth about mountaintop removal. Stop this stupidity of Saudi Arabia of coal, and maybe we could put the mountains back together like they were again. No, Senator Clinton, sorry. The Appalachian Mountains are very Humpty Dumpty-ish where that is concerned. All the king's horses and all the king's men cannot put the Appalachian Mountains back together again, honey. And we don't want to be Saudi Arabians, Barack. We just don't. It's kind of hard to get around up and down these hills with the, you know, with the required ceremonial tribal costumes on, among other things. Those really are built for flat land and sand. But then again, if we mountaintop remove West Virginia, that's what we'll have. Because all the topsoil will wash away, and you won't be able to grow moss anywhere in this state. So, you know, still waiting, haven't seen it yet. God knows that fish wrap out of Beckley, the Rag Herald, hasn't, nothing yet about his speech. But here's from the Washington Post. Here's some real hard-hitting political journalism. Barack Obama went trolling for votes with the white working-class voters that... Jesus, we can't get through the first sentence without injecting race into it. Woo! White working-class voters that have always given him trouble. Given him trouble? What? They were throwing rocks at his house? In the best place he could find them, a sports bar in the bloom of March Madness. I'm fishing for a few votes around here. At least I can show off my basketball knowledge, he said at the bar on 35th Street. It's a... What? Ah, damn it, stop it. Now, okay, call in. Shoot me an email. Tell me what image you get when I read this, please. You heard this? I'm fishing for a few votes around here. At least I can show off my basketball knowledge. Okay, good. I'm there. I'd love to see his brackets. I think I've already been whacked a couple of times today. Okay, so he says he confessed at Murad's on 35th Street on a muddy street in Charleston. Where's my coconut shells? I need to make the horse hoof noises. Cloppity, 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 cloppity. On a muddy street in Charleston. Now, I know we've got some West Virginia listeners. We don't have nearly as many West Virginia listeners as we do rest of the country and rest of the world listeners. But anybody want to chime in on the muddy streets of Charleston? Yeah, they're all dirt. And when it rains, it's just a sea of mud. What is this, a scene out of Little Big Man? On the muddy street in Charleston. 35th Street comes off of a bridge over the Kanawha River. That's a good, you know, 150 feet in the air. I mean, not in the air. I mean, it's connected to the roads and everything. You know what I mean. The muddy streets of Charleston. Please! This is the Washington Post. Well, of course, that explains everything, doesn't it? Over limp chicken wings. Yeah, we're so screwed up in West Virginia, we can't even get the chicken wings right. I've had Murad's wings. They're damn good wings. Used to go there for Monday night football when I lived in Charleston. Fun time. Cheap drafts. Over limp chicken wings and the blare of basketball, Obama and the Murad's patrons talked bracketology, energy policy, health care, and hot sauce. I'm going to be ill.
Honest to God, I'm going to be ill. This makes me crazy. Can't get two paragraphs into a Barack Obama story in West Virginia without the mud rut roads of West Virginia. Hi, who they got?
Hey, Nanette.
Hey, Nanette.
Ah!
Do you want to scream?
Charleston.
The mud rutted roads of Charleston.
Oh, my God.
I mean, they've had pavement in Charleston for 10 or 15 years now that I know of.
Yeah, I know. Oh, my God. Who wrote that?
This is some goober named Jonathan Weissman writing for a segment in the Washington Post called The Trail, A Daily Diary of Campaign 2008.
Yeah.
And wait. Nanette.
Right.
You are a cook of extraordinary talents, if I say so myself, and I do.
Oh.
Limp. He was eating limp chicken wings.
Limp?
Limp. Limp chicken wings.
Are you saying it with a W or an L?
L. I'm sorry.
Limp.
L-I-M-P. Yeah, limp chicken wings.
Honey, if somebody laid a bowl of limp wings in front of me, I'd say, bruh.
Yeah, but limp chicken wing. How do you have But wait, how do you have a limp chicken wing? They got bones in them to keep them from being limp.
I know. Oh, they have to make us look just as bad as they can.
Yeah, I'm surprised that the guy that got to talk to Barack Obama wasn't portrayed as wearing his best pair of high button greave boots that he hasn't worn since the year before. Why does it have to be this way, Nanette?
Because people look down on us, Bob.
Does it make them feel better to look down on us?
Exactly.
I mean...
And the school. It's the University of Charleston. It used to be Morris Hart.
Yeah, Morris Hart. My aunt got her teaching certificate there. Yes,
well,
indeed.
My daughter got her nursing degree. It has nothing to do with the University of West Virginia.
Well, there isn't a University of West Virginia.
West Virginia, you know what I'm talking about.
But I mean, WVU Charleston's the medical school.
Yeah, it's attached to Charleston Area Medical Center.
Right, over there at Memorial.
Uh-huh.
And University of Charleston, but no, it's West Virginia University in Charleston.
No. He was at Riggleman Hall.
On the campus of UC, right?
Yeah.
What was with the invitation-only crowd?
I didn't even know about that. They never gave that on the local news, that it was invitation-only. I know that the Clinton thing in Huntington was invitation-only, but I didn't know the Obama thing was. Who did they invite?
I don't know. This political story, nothing about energy policy, nothing. No. This writer wants to write about wings. He says, while he didn't seem...
Limp wings and muddy roads.
Limp wings, muddy roads, and universities that don't exist.
Good grief.
We
really need to start writing some LTE to the Post.
I'm going to keep this one in my tabs here on my browser. This one might just engender a snarky little letter from me.
Me too. I've been sitting here just floored. Absolutely floored at this.
Well, you haven't heard the fun part. We got one more West Virginia image to work in, Nanette.
Huh?
We got one more West Virginia image to work in.
Oh, God. Okay.
What he didn't seem too thrilled with were the wings, which were on the pale side. Pale? Pale wings? Pale wings are raw wings, aren't they? I mean, I'll defer to you. You're the cook in this conversation.
I don't know what to say, Bob. I'm just at a loss for words.
You ever been to Murad's?
Yes.
I mean, they don't suck.
No.
Yeah, which were on the pale side. He took one, reluctantly, then gamely offered, that's a pretty tasty wig. I don't know if the hot sauce is all that hot. Now I have remarked on that. For some reason or other, we've lost our taste for hot in this state.
Yeah.
You order, you know, you go and order wings and you order them hot. You have to, you know, I have to look at the guy and go, no, I really meant hot. You know, I want sweat on the forehead and all of that, please.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if the hot sauce is all that hot, he said. Now, the guy, the writer says, Obama's magic just might be working. Derek Buzzard, 30, a burly paralegal with a shaved head and earrings, seemed impressed. So we got to get the final reference to the burly. Us Mountaineers, we're burly, Nanette.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell Paul to get to work on his burly. We gotta all be burly. With a shaved head and earrings.
Well, he could do the shaved head and earrings. I guess he'd have to grow a beard.
It's got to be a burly beard, mind you.
Oh, okay.
You know, none of this fancy, well-trimmed stuff. It's got to be a burly beard. My God.
Oh.
What, I mean, you know, you come across the 35th Street Bridge going toward McCorkle Avenue.
Which is a four-lane road.
Yeah.
Yeah, with a median in the middle.
But no, now it's a muddy street in Charleston.
It may have been muddy in my granddad's day, but I never remember seeing mud there.
I mean, if the river was over its banks, which it isn't.
No.
It would have to go up how far to get to 35th Street? I mean, it would have to be a 500-year flood, right?
At least. And besides, we have locks and dams to control that.
This is amazing. Oh, and by the way, for the West Virginia fans, what's this guy's... Jonathan Wiseman had to get in a dig because Obama gave the Mountaineers no chance to beat Arizona tonight. And he also picked Pitt for the Final Four.
You're talking basketball.
Yeah, I know. That might not...
I don't do
Yeah,
basketball.
That's not... Yeah.
But I don't know. The muddy street, you know, I could understand the confusion over school, but the muddy street got me.
It blows
me. I never in my life.
I don't know where the mud came from. Maybe they trucked it in for the visit. Maybe it's what Obama wanted to see. I want to see the muddy roads of West Virginia. You know, those country roads they keep singing about.
Well, tell him to come over here and he can see all the coal, mud, gob you want to on the road, but not in Charleston.
And that's the thing. You know, he left lunch in Charleston, and he traveled, I'm sure, down the turnpike to Beckley.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just over those ridges that you see, the turnpike, you know, it's like Poppy said, Gerard said the other night when he called in. He drove the turnpike, and he said, those are the most beautiful mountains I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And you drive the turnpike between Beckley and Charleston, and you would never know there's a problem.
There's one place right up above Shelia. Now, if you look real close, you can see the top of the mountain has no trees.
That's the
only place I can think of that, since we leave here, we know what to look for. You know.
Yeah.
There's one place that I noticed right above Shelia that the trees are gone. But it's been reseeded. Now, if you see mountain ridges that the top of the tree canopy looks thick, that hasn't been touched. If it looks scraggly, there's still trees up there. All behind that is in mountaintop. You know, it's been blasted, and they just leave a little bit of trees up there to kind of hide it. You can see it all over the place here. If you know what you're looking for, you can spot where there's a mountaintop removal site.
And yet, it would have been so easy. I mean, I know they want to go and speak to the largest aggregation of people possible. But, you know, when they flew him in here, could they not have... Because one of the things, when I flew to Massachusetts, Lorella pointed out to me, Nanette, that Judy had pointed out to her, do you know that the flight patterns in and out of Yeager in Charleston now deliberately avoid flyovers of mountaintop removal areas?
That doesn't surprise me. They don't want the public to see it.
And I've flown into Charleston on a number of occasions, and back then you did fly over mountaintop removal sites. Now you don't.
Mm-hmm.
They loop around to keep from doing it.
No.
But, you know, you just wish he could see it.
I don't know how you would go about ever getting the big-name politicians to ever see it. And here Hillary said on the hearings and everything else that she didn't know enough about it to make a decision. That burned me up.
Yeah.
You know, it just, I thought, no matter who we vote for, Bob, we're screwed.
I fear you may be right.
I mean, I
want to think that either Hillary or Obama can be turned to see and do the right thing, because it is worth remembering we didn't have near this problem during the Clinton administration.
No, we didn't.
Because we had enforcement of the Clean Water Act. That was before all that clarifying took place.
Mm-hmm.
But
I don't know whether Hillary would. I don't know. I have reservations about Hillary. I really do.
Do they not understand, Nanette, that regardless of which person is nominated by the Democrats, do they not understand that the likes of Blankenship and the West Virginia Coal Association are going to come out force, and Walker Machinery,
mm-hmm,
are going to come out four square for John McCain?
Oh, sure.
I mean, if John McCain... bit the head off of Don Blankenship's cat right in front of him, he would still pour millions into McCain's campaign.
Bob, I'm going to make a prediction.
All right.
I predict that McCain will carry West Virginia.
I do, too.
I have no doubt in my mind.
And that doesn't do your heart any good to say it, and it doesn't do my heart and my ears any good to hear it.
You know, I lay in bed and think about this stuff, Margaret. But I thought about all this, and I thought, okay, West Virginians, for the most part, Bob, and I hate to say this, they're racist.
Well, it's interesting you should mention that.
I mean that.
Because I got to thinking early this morning, I'll bet you that stupid little radio station in Beckley is just on fire right now.
Probably so.
And it was. It was.
Also, the fundamentalist part of the religious sect in West Virginia is very anti-woman. They're not going to vote for Hillary either.
No, they're not going to vote for Hillary any more than they were going to vote for Charlotte Pritt. We've been to this movie.
Yeah, we have. And that's what scares me about Looney McCain carrying this state. And it shames me to say so.
It does. And like I said, that hateful little talk radio station in Beckley was on fire this morning with more bigotry than you've heard in a year.
But, honey, I don't listen to that anymore.
Well, I don't either, but I just decided to check it in kind of the way you slow down going by a car wreck. And it was all over the place. The usual cast of characters. Yeah. It was ugly. But, you know, what more do you expect? Beckley, as much as I hate it, you know, there's a lot. It is far less cosmopolitan than Charleston or Huntington,
mm-hmm,
and it is far more sucked up with fundamentalists and right wingers. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised to walk into any church in Beckley, West Virginia, on any Sunday. Now, by any church, I mean I'm not talking about, you know, your Unitarians or your.
Is there any of those up there?
Yeah. There's some Unitarians in Beckley, like four. But, you know, the normal churches, your Lutherans and your Episcopals and stuff, I exclude from this. But if you were to, I guarantee you, any given Sunday between now and November, or especially now and May, I guarantee you, any Baptist church, any Methodist church, some Presbyterian churches, and your independent, free will, holy roller, ghost of God churches, you know, those, that bunch.
Oh, yeah.
I guarantee
I
you.
Those as well.
Any of those, you walk into those and you will hear that Barack Obama wants to take the oath on the Quran. And there will not be a voice in that building stand up and to call that stinking preacher a liar.
Well, Elizabeth forwarded me an email that she got today and she was livid. And it had to do about Barack Obama's wife being first lady. And it had some of the ugliest stuff in it that ever was. And I sent it back to her and I said, Elizabeth, I said, whoever sent this to you, you return it. And you tell them you don't want this kind of stuff sent to you anymore. And how people can call themselves Christians and spread lies, unfounded truth, just to harm somebody during an election, they can't be Christian.
The thing is, though, Nanette, I don't know if they know they're lying. Because they've been misled by people that they think don't lie to them.
They stand here and listen to these preachers. They don't research anything. They're gullible. They swallow everything hook, line, and sinker. And it just makes me so mad. I can't stand it.
So in 2000, it was Charlton Heston telling the assembled mouth-breathing faithful in Beckley that Al Gore was going to get their guns.
Oh, my ex-son-in-law went to that.
And in 2004, it was the flyer that the Republican National Committee sent to West Virginia showing John Kerry putting a knife in a Bible.
We had those all stuck on our windshields when we come out of church one Sunday.
And so what do they do in 08? They've done Bibles and they've done guns. Is it gays this year?
It's gays. It's going to be Muslims. It's going to be... They could use just a myriad of things.
Is it going to be the flyer with a picture of Obama putting his hand in the air and his hand on a Quran taking the oath? You think that would work?
Probably him in his native garb that they have circulating all over the place.
You're killing me.
Well, did you see the picture?
Yes, oh yes.
They'll probably have a picture like that. Just ugliness.
Yeah, God forbid they should show the picture of George Bush in his purple polka-dotted pajamas. Yeah, because that.
I was going to say short.
No, that's Bill Bennett. Oh, God. The muddy streets of Charleston.
Well, Bob, I've taken enough of your time. I just couldn't get over the muddy streets in Charleston. Oh, God.
You know, we've got us a new shoe store in Charleston, first one we've ever had. People driving 100, 200 miles in their buggies to get shoes to go with their overhauls.
I will tell you a story about Canal City, though.
All right.
Okay. My great-grandfather had an offer to buy all of the land in Canal City for very little money. And back then, Canal City was nothing but a swamp. He said, why on earth would I want to put good money in a swamp? Well... Look at it now.
Swamps can be drained.
Up the head.
Yep.
And that's what's wrong with a lot of people now. They're not looking ahead.
You could be living on one of those mountaintops overlooking the swamp now.
I can hear you.
Oh, that's weird. Your volume's gone down too, Nanette. That's strange.
I don't know what's wrong here.
I think your battery may be dying.
You there?
I'm here.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead and go because I can't hardly hear you.
All right. That's strange. You've faded away, too.
All
right. We'll talk to you later. Haul up your petticoats and your skirts when you're walking through the muddy streets of Charleston, okay?
I can't hear you.
All right. Talk to you later, Nanette.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
If they go campaign in Kansas... Are we do the Jonathan Weissmans of the world write stories about how Barack Obama's coming to Dodge and there's going to be a showdown? If Hillary Clinton goes to Mississippi, does Jonathan Weissman write stories about her sipping juleps on the veranda? If Barack Obama goes to Kentucky, does Jonathan Weissman write stories about him drinking sour mash bourbon and the limestone filtered water that makes it in a house with a picket fence on the old pike in Lexington? No, 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 and no. But if a national politician comes to West Virginia, we, by God, have to get a reference to the muddy streets of Charleston, which, in all truth, really have been paved for about 100 years. get kind of tired of the bigotry. Get kind of tired of the stereotyping. And what's more, I got to tell you, I'd like to have a little damn news about what he actually said. I'm pretty sure that his remarks are over in Beckley by now. But, you know, still nothing. And I've refreshed the search page on my efforts to find, you know, meaningful reporting on what happened here. Still nothing. And I guess that's just how it goes with America's Johnny on the spot, can't slip nothing past him, professional media. Back to the phones. Hi, who I got?
Hi, this is Juanita.
Hey, Juanita, how are you?
I'm fine, how are you?
Yeah, well, you know, I just got in from walking the muddy streets and then just scraped some of the gumbo off the bottom of my boots.
Where he was from?
Pardon? Oh, he's from the Washington Post.
Is that the one the Mooney's on?
No, that's the Times. This is supposedly the...
Maybe that was the what?
No, this is the real... No, this is the real newspaper in Washington.
That sounds like a cheap novel or something.
Well, I kept expecting to hear the whole, the Clint Eastwood,
I think it was insulting.
You know, that kind of stuff.
I think it was insulting to y'all and to Obama, too, you know. I mean, Barack, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
And limp wings, you know, we can't, we're such a bunch of screw-ups here in West Virginia, we can't even keep the bones and the wings from going limp.
What's the matter with
But the funny thing is, we cook them to death, which would make you think they'd be real burned up and you know, charred, but
y'all just aren't highfalutin enough like we people.
But the wings are pale. The wings are pale.
That is pretty good. Oh, Lordy.
Now, I've had some pale wings, and they're kind of pretty. Now, down Decatur, Alabama way, at a place called Big Bob Gibson's Barbecue, they do white barbecue wings, and they're kind of pale, and they're real good, and they're not limp.
Yeah, sometimes you cook them, and they're not that brown, you know, but that doesn't mean they're not good. Oh, well. I just wanted to call you back and let you know I found out about the Florida delegates that aren't going to be counted as of yet.
Yeah.
Hillary got 105, or will, or what, whatever. Barack is 67, and Edwards is 13. Hillary got, like, almost 50% of the vote.
Well, I mean, everything I'm seeing says that the time has passed for doing anything, so all they can do is take it to the credentials committee. I mean...
Well, that's the way they're... So Edwards does have 13, if they allow it. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me, but whatever.
I know. And one of the things that Barack Obama did say today was that he expects, he doesn't expect the Michigan thing to be resolved either.
He does not?
No, it does not.
Well, I don't see how they could give her those now. Maybe in Florida, but I don't see how they could give her those in Michigan. Because we had everybody on there. You know. And you know what? Mike Gravel?
Yeah.
Got almost as many votes down here as Dodd.
Oh, my.
A little over 4,000 each. Nobody else got any delegates. Promise. So that's my little tale about Florida.
It's a mess. It's just a mess. And I hope
in next week.
Yeah, really. No kidding.
Yeah, be interested. Just getting back to that article, though, it'd be interesting to look up that guy and see where he writes other stuff.
Lordy, if he writes like he wrote that, well,
I can't believe he does. Do you?
He probably writes in a similar vein. It's just that he doesn't drag out the muddy streets until he gets to West Virginia. I promise you, Juanita, I know you're in Florida and everything, but you can go all over West Virginia and walk all kinds of streets, and they're paved, really. People wearing shoes and
really?
And
Yeah, and pants that aren't overalls, and they don't have patches in the knees and the back, and we're not walking around carrying the old family shoot gun and you know, and a jug of moonshine liquor on the other thumb.
Yes.
No, really, I mean it's downright civilized here sometimes.
Well, I declare, I declare.
Mercy sakes.
What'd you say that guy's name was?
Jonathan Weissman. Jonathan Weissman.
Donald who?
Jonathan Weissman. W-E-I-S-M-A-N. W-E-I-S-M-A-N.
E-I-S-M-A-N.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, I was thinking if he was for the Mooney thing, maybe he was, that was Mooney's way of telling him how to write. I mean, that doesn't profit anybody anything, that kind of a thing. You think he was even there?
I'm beginning to wonder. I wonder if he just, you know, sort of phoned it in.
Because I know that we've had those in our little newspaper down here. We've had articles that, you know, doggone good and well, the guy wasn't there. The people weren't there because you were there. Maybe you were there and it wasn't like that at all. But,
well, it's those pale, limp wings that are just, I mean,
yeah.
Because I'm a little bit of a cook and I couldn't make a limp wing if I tried.
Right, me neither.
Because you got to take the bones out of them first and then it's just chicken. So,
maybe he's never had a chicken wing. Maybe he doesn't know. Maybe
no. He knows his wings.
Comes to bone.
No, he knows his wings because he was saying that the sauce wasn't hot enough. Oh
yeah.
Lord, you know, Barack needs to get in touch with me. I'll make him some daggum wings, and
yeah.
We'll see this, and we'll see the sweat pop out on his forehead.
Yeah. Because
that's the way we like him around here.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm gonna let you go and.
All right, Juanita, good to hear from you, and you know, update us on Florida, because, you know, it may change by tomorrow.
That's a great show last night.
Oh, well, thank you. I had a lot of fun with Mark.
Yeah, that was really good. I like the discussion that you had.
I think Mark and I have a real chemistry. Maybe we'll take the show on the road sometime.
Okay.
All right, you take care, Juanita.
Oh, I want to tell you one more thing.
Oh, sure.
I want you to thank now, what's her name? Suzanne. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I looked up that Winter Soldiers, and I've seen most of it now. You know what they show on.
Oh, you mean, what Susan posted on the. Yeah, yeah.
For guiding me to where it was because I hadn't seen it.
Pretty moving stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it's straight out. No apologies.
No. No, it's just facts.
Yeah.
Now, the right-wingers can't deal with facts, and that's why they hate stuff like Winter Patriot.
Oh, yeah.
But it just is what it is.
Right, right. Yeah. But I wanted to thank her for bringing that up.
Okay, well, I think you just did.
Yeah.
Juanita,
you've been thanking people.
I do, too. A little more courtesy and a little more politeness, and this would be a heck of a lot more pleasant country to live in.
That's right.
All right, Juanita, you take care, dear.
Okay. Hey,
yeah.
Ask me a question.
Ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
Why should I ask you a question?
So?
Oh, that's good.
No, I had to get that in.
Yeah, that's really, really good. So? You got to say it like that, too, Juanita. So?
Oh.
So? God, it's hard to tell the difference between him and Boris Karloff's Frankenstein. Or was it Boris Karloff? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Fire bad.
Oh, me.
Oh, so you know, you're just gonna sit back and relax for the rest of the night. So.
Well. Yeah, so, we get it right.
Juanita,
yeah,
you have a good night.
Else.
All right.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
That one caught me off guard. That's good. Ask me a question. So. Reminds me of the old Mel Blanc bit that he used to do with Jack Benny, where he played the little Mexican guy. Jack Benny, see. You waiting on the bus? See? Ah, okay. So you're visiting family members? See? Your sister? See? What's her name? Sue. What'd she do for a living? So. But it was a lot more funny when Mel Blanc and Jack Benny did it than when Richard B. Dick Big Time Cheney does it. Vice President Cheney, there's 4,000 dead Americans in Iraq, so... Oh, by the way, just one more. We'll wrap up the Obama stuff now, because God knows there's another hour easy of stuff that needs getting to. One last piece of reportage from Obama's remarks in Charleston to the invited audience. The hoi polloi apparently were put in a gym somewhere, and loudspeakers blared the speech to them. This little paragraph, though, sort of makes little hairs stand up on the back of my neck. Like Clinton in her speech Wednesday, this is a direct... Now, this is not from Jonathan Wiseman, okay? This is from Jake Stump of the Charleston Daily Mail. And Jake Stump of the Charleston Daily Mail, and just so you can get your hand on the pulse beat of West Virginia newspapers, the Charleston Daily Mail is a right-wing rag that, frankly, is not fit to have bird droppings from your pet parakeet land on it. I mean, it's just that bad. It's a fish wrap, without a doubt. Like Clinton in her speech Wednesday, Obama touted, wait for it, you know the next three letters, right? Or next three words, right? Come on, everybody. I'm watching the chat room. Like Clinton in her speech on Wednesday, Obama touted, one, two, three, clean coal technology. Jesus wept. When you get coal the way they get coal around here, it is impossible for that coal to ever get clean. But trying to get something like that through to a politician who relies for his campaign cash or hers, on corporations. Well, forget about it. So we'll come back after a little break, find out what's going on with labor news, that kind of thing. This is America's Liberal Voice. Listener supported, as best you can. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Young and in my prime, I left my home in Caroline, and now all I do is sit and pine for all the folks I left behind. I've got them Blue Ridge Mountain blues, and I stand right here and say, my grip is packed to travel. I'll be scratching gravel for that Blue Ridge far away. I can see two heads of snowy white, and in their window there's a light. It seems I can hear them both recite, oh, where is our wandering boy tonight? I've got them Blue Ridge Mountain blues, and I'll stand right here and say, my grip is packed to travel, soon be scratching gravel for
gonna do right by my walk, and I'm gonna do right by my talk. I want to hang around that cabin door with no work or worries anymore. I'm got them Blue Ridge Mountain blues, and I'll stand right here and say my grip is packed to travel soon, be scratching gravel for that Blue Ridge far away.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Wednesday was the National Day of Action against the Iraq War on the fifth anniversary of the invasion and occupation of Iraq by the U.S. military. A range of protest actions occurred coast to coast, and civil disobedience led to several arrests in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere. In the San Francisco area, protests were held at the offices of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. There were also protests against military recruiters. In Washington, about 30 people were arrested when they blocked IRS offices. U.S. Labor Against the War added labor's voice to Wednesday's protest in Washington, D.C., as the Iraq War U.S. death toll approaches 4,000. As the nation faces protests over the fifth anniversary of the Iraq War, a group of Indian nationals are marching to Washington for a whole other reason. Jesse Russell reports.
Nearly 100 Indian workers who allege they were exploited through human trafficking between an Indian and U.S. company are marching from New Orleans to Washington, D.C. to hold accountable Indian ambassador to the United States, Ronan Sen, who they say has been unresponsive to their situation. The workers were hired by an Indian recruiter on behalf of Signal International, a U.S. oil rig construction company. The workers allege they arrived in New Orleans and have since been forced to work under exploitive conditions. The workers say they are launching a satyagraha against the ambassador. They contrasted their march with the salt satyagraha employed by Mahatma Gandhi as a form of nonviolent protest against the British salt tax in colonial India. The workers said the ambassador's response to their plight was to send diplomats uneducated on the issue of human trafficking who held meetings on company grounds under the company's watch. The workers have also asked for the embassy to put pressure on the United States to restrict travel to India for Signal's recruiters.
The International Labor Organization says the U.S. Labor Board's decision expanding the definition of supervisors is contrary to international freedom of association standards. AFL-CIO President John Sweeney says the U.S. belongs to the ILO and is bound to honor its principles. He says the Bush Labor Board's decision broadening the definition of supervisors to exempt more workers from legal union rights protections is shameful. The ILO released its decision in response to an AFL-CIO complaint. Jesse Russell has today's economic report.
Could the NCAA tournament be the final push needed to send the U.S. economy into a recession? U.S. businesses lost an estimated $1.2 billion in worker productivity during last year's NCAA tournament. 2006 was the first year that most games were broadcasted for free on the Internet. So now, in 2008, with streaming internet much more prevalent in offices across America, the estimate for lost productivity is $1.7 billion.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Wow, 9 minutes past the hour. Welcome to the final hour of Head On for this Thursday evening. Sorry about that. Didn't know that Labor Radio was going to be a repeat. Yes, somebody took the day off today. Tomorrow's Good Friday. I guess that makes today sort of so-so Thursday, and I guess Labor Radio gets the day off. Quick email in from our buddy Jeb. He says, you're not alone, Bob. I-55 travels from the entire north of Mississippi to New Orleans and farther. If you didn't know better, it's a forested state. Go 10 feet beyond the interstate, and there is total devastation. Go between Baton Rouge and New Orleans on Highway 1 and see Cancer Alley. Canada's sucking oil sands out of their ground. What's the consequence of that? It's a consequence that we're going to learn a very, very hard, hard way. Well, maybe not us. Maybe our grandkids. Ah, who cares about them anyway, right? And you know that voice you heard on the intro there, that's our good buddy B-Rez, Ryan Reznor. I don't think you've ever heard him talk for himself before. You're gonna. B-Rez was at the Obama speech in Beckley today. Hey, B.
Yes.
How are you?
I'm doing great, Bob. Actually, I want to correct you. It is not a so-so Thursday. It is an amazing Thursday.
All right.
It is an amazing Thursday. Now, what exactly did you want to know in detail, and then I'll tell you what exactly happened.
Well, let's just start. I mean, it sounds like you're pretty fired up. It sounds like it was an inspiring oration, town hall meeting, whatever.
How much time you got to talk to me is really what the question is. I got a lot to say.
Oh man, this is conversation radio. I got as much time as you want to talk.
Well, here's where I want to speak up for the area. First off, is the fact that everyone there was from a diverse side of life. No one was the same. There were white people, black people, Mexican people. I mean, people of all races, people of all colors, people of all sexes, people of all everything were there. Because everyone has one common goal. Because it's not about any of that stuff. It's not about religion anymore. It's just about the fact that people are hungry for a different life. A different way in America, and seeing that many people come out and stand in the cold for an hour, most people, I remember when Beckley did Fuel, the band, they came to town, and people wouldn't wait in the summertime in line and actually left, but people waited for an hour in the cold to hear what could quite possibly be the greatest mix between JFK and Martin Luther King Jr. that we have ever seen in the history of my life, and I think yours.
So that's tall praise singing there, Brian. A mix of JFK and Martin Luther King. What was it that gave you that sense?
Just the way he brings these people together. I mean, everyone is together for a common goal, and it's change. What I want to make it clear right out the gate is I'm not anti-Hillary. I think Hillary is wonderful. I think she is a great, great woman, and I'm 100% behind her. If she gets the nomination, I will vote for her in a heartbeat because of the fact that, I mean, she's amazing in the same sense. But the reason why I will vote for Barack Obama is simply because that he's running. And I mean, if he wasn't, then maybe I'd vote for Hillary. But he is, and he's brilliant. He is exactly what we need. After 8 years of retardation, this is what we need.
Well, and 8 years, we can't, what's more, we can't do another 4 or 8. And John McCain is that. It's 4 or 8 more years of George W. Bush.
It's 4 or 8 more years of the same thing. Even if he is what the Republicans say he is, as far as you know, he's an all right guy. Okay, yeah, maybe he is an all right guy. Maybe he's not the tyrant that we're used to. But in the same
B, he's a bigger idiot than Bush. I started out this program by pointing out that if John McCain is elected president, we will look back on the genius of George W. Bush. I promise you.
Even do his hair. How can he run? He can't even reach to his head. How can he run the country? And that's my question. And the point of the fact is John McCain can be a great man, and that's fine and dandy. But he's not Barack Obama. He's not even close to Hillary. And I do not want to go through my life go through the rest of the next 4 years or the next 8 years or however long this dictatorship is going to happen. I don't want to do that anymore. I want change. And so does every other American, because 10% of the population is controlled. controlling 90% of the wealth, and that 90% that all of the other people in the world live in, I mean, everybody in the United States lives in that 90% except for 10%, and they're sharing 10% of the wealth? 90% of the people? It's not fair. It's not fair, and we need change. There is no change in John McCain.
Let me ask you, Brian. First off, you talk about people standing in the cold to hear Senator Obama. This was, of course, at the what used to be called the Raleigh County Armory. Now it's the Beckley Civic Center.
Convention Center.
Yes, the Convention Center. I take it was in the arena?
It sure was.
And how many people were there?
A lot. A lot of
people. I mean, was it packed? I mean, was it SRO? I mean,
We were at the very back of the line when we showed up, and we were at the very back of the parking lot on the second level, all the way to the fence.
Wow.
The line was far back, and everyone went through the security. Everyone stood and waited in line. Most people were waiting in line in the cold for at least an hour. And these were people from all walks of life, and there was one constant conversation going on between everybody in line. Everyone was talking about one thing, is change and genius. And it doesn't matter what color you are, and it doesn't matter what your race is, your religion. And I mean, there's so much things that are going against Barack Obama. You have people that are sending out MySpace. I mean, have you got any of these MySpace messages that are, who is Barack Obama? Have you got any of these retarded emails?
Oh, God, yes.
And they want to say that Barack Obama is Muslim. He's not Muslim. He's Christian.
Yeah.
And you know,
We've been fighting that battle for months now, Brian.
I realize that. I just haven't had the chance to.
No. I know that. But no, it's got real legs. It's got traction. The right wingers have got the mouth breathing, ignorant fundamentalist religion industry types absolutely convinced that he's a Muslim who wants to take his oath of office on the Quran.
Which is crazy. That is crazy. He's not. I mean, what is up with this whole? Oh, he won't put his hand on his heart. Well, you know what? I don't think that's.
Oh, no. Because see, I've seen the pictures of George Bush, and during the pledge, he puts his hand on his navel. No kidding. Let me ask you this. I just read some numbers and shared them with the audience. Right now, Hillary Clinton is leading Barack Obama by about 59% to 27%, or 57 to 22, something like big numbers. Do you think he can make up that gap between now and mid-May?
Well, hopefully, if he is doing the exact same thing in every city in America that he just did in my city, then I hope that somehow, somewhere, some people go and find, you know, other people, because there are more people that would be behind Barack Obama than realize. And there's so many people that are turned off by the fact that he, you know, oh, they think he's a Muslim. Oh, he's going to, you know, have the Quran. Oh, he's kin to Saddam Hussein because he's got the...
Yeah, I know. Yeah, the middle name thing. Yeah.
I mean, there's so many people out there spreading so much stuff, and that's exactly why the Republicans are in charge of who we pick from. And we know that from the gate. They're in charge of who we pick from, and that's just a system we have to live in. And they're in charge of who we pick from by stating the fact that exactly, you know, about what they did to Howard Dean. You know, they did that to Howard Dean. They made him look like an idiot when all he
because they wanted to run against Kerry, sure.
Well, yeah, and he was just as passionate as everybody else in America, except for they made him look like an idiot on TV, and everyone felt stupid to be behind Howard Dean at that point. And then it was, oh, well, let's vote for Kerry because Howard Dean yelled because he was passionate, which made no sense. But the Republicans feed us what they want to feed
well,
us.
Well, look, let's get into a little bit of detail here. You're one of these so-called younger voters that's behind Barack Obama. The people you run with, are they actually? Let me just ask you.
Let's go back. Let so-called younger voters, is that exactly what you think? Now, Bob.
No. I'm talking about the political conventional wisdom, Brian. They're saying that Barack Obama's voter base is much younger. The voter base is excited because of his message of change. Yada 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 yada.
It's people from all walks of life.
Okay, wait a minute. That's what I'm trying to get a question out here, man. Is that what it looked like? Was it just a bunch of young folks? I mean, was it old folks? What did the crowd look like?
I had a beautiful conversation standing in line with probably 6 to 7 people that were completely different. We're talking about white people, black people. We're talking about older people. We're talking about middle-aged people. We're talking about people my age. We're talking about people much younger than me. Because I am 25. I'm not the spring chicken that I once was. And the fact of the matter is it's about, you know, it's about intelligence, really. If you go through the line and you talk to everybody that's in the line, you're not going to talk to a bunch of idiots. And that's the difference. See, that's the difference maker, is everybody wants to focus on the wrong things. Nobody focuses about the right thing, and the right thing is progression. None of the other topics matter at this point. We are so far in the hole, we need to find the person that can lead us out of the darkness, and Barack Obama is the person.
Okay, I'm taking your word, because I, too, am committed to voting for the Democratic nominee in November without any reservations whatsoever.
Exactly.
First of all, still, you know, you didn't rub it in and say, you know, old people like you, Bob, or anything like that, so I appreciate it, B.
Well, I don't think you're old.
I know. But
I've got the most respect for you in the world, Bob, and you know that.
I know.
We carried the head-on banner throughout my entire conversation experience through the hour-long line.
No kidding.
You'll actually have a lot of new listeners tonight, I'm sure.
Wonderful. That'd be just wonderful.
And you know what? They were already Bob Kincaid fans. And I actually, I was telling the whole story of exactly, you know, what's going on with Head On and how successful Head On's been, and how I'm just excited for you, because I know for a fact that, you know, this is exactly what we need in America.
Thank you, B. You know, we're growing all the time. It's actually quite exciting. What did he lead with? What did he open with? What was the first issue that he struck?
Well, he said thank you about 3,000 or 4,000 times, because the crowd was so overwhelmingly excited to see a man who's going to change the whole world, not just the United States. He's not focusing on one thing. He's focusing on a global change, and he just started with with his whole appeal. I mean, the way he carried himself, the way he is exactly like we are. He's not some suit. He's not someone who's already been there. He's not, you know, and there's so many things that are in, you know, actually, if I said exactly what I think right now, you'd probably be upset with me. Because I agree with, and you know, I'm not one to agree with preachers. But I agree with the preacher that the big controversy is.
No fighting. No, I got no problem with Jeremiah Wright. I don't.
I have no problem with him right now, because honestly, right now, if we don't get out of our situation, we are damned.
Yeah, we are.
We are damned. He is not.
So after the roaring chorus of applause and 36 thank yous, I mean, did he talk about the war, the occupation?
He did talk about the war. He talked about one thing. Let me go through everything, and then we'll get to the war. The one thing that he talked about that really impressed me was the fact that he was going to tax people for the chemicals and the things they put into the ozone layer, as far as you know everything that's going, as far as pollution goes, and he's going to tax all those people to raise money for research to find better gas mileage cars and to push out better economic, you know, everything for the economy, and everything to raise money for different causes and for different people. And it's amazing how, you know, college students under his plan, you know, which is not some no child left behind deal, it's a real deal, and his plan to put students through on public service, and they do a public service, and it can actually take credit from their college. I mean, these are all amazing plans, and the reason why, I mean, the things that he's got in motion can be so solid is because of the fact that he's brilliant. I mean, he can put this stuff together unlike anyone else. And I mean, did you happen to see his speech of the races? I'm sure you.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Sure. Yeah.
I mean, were you not amazed with that?
I thought it was brilliantly done. And I thought it was a thousand. I thought it was a speech only he could make. And I thought, for my purposes, it really put to rest the Reverend Wright stuff to the extent that people felt like it needed to be put to rest. Personally, I don't see anybody calling John McCain to disavow Reverend Hagee or Rod Parsley or any of the hate ministers that the white Louis Farrakhans that he's got hanging around with him. But it was a very effective, very moving speech, and I said last night it was like the first statement that somebody wanting to recover in a 12-step program makes. You know, we've got to acknowledge that we got a problem before we can make the problem any better. So yeah, it was a damn good speech. Let me ask you, Brian. What about this is Beckley, okay? And it's the heart. I mean, you've heard what the right wing sounds like when they call in on that hateful little. Little program there in the morning at the right-wing radio station. Did he, and you know how pro-coal they are, did he say anything about coal?
Yes, he did. He said that he wanted to make cleaner way. He actually addressed coal on two different times. He addressed coal the first time, and he wanted to create cleaner coal alternatives.
Clean coal technology. Okay, cleaner coal alternatives or clean coal technology?
Clean coal technology, and clean, I mean we're not getting. He doesn't want to get rid of coal. Coal is a great industry, and his hometown of Illinois.
But you realize, B, that when he says clean coal technology, that means more mountains keep getting blown up in West Virginia.
That's not true. We talked about mountaintop removal, and he talked about how
there
are better ways to do that. I'm not real familiar with it as far as like coal technology, and I don't know a lot about the coal industry. But I know for a fact that he was against mountaintop removal, and he was also for a cleaner coal system.
Well, one of the things that we keep trying to educate people on is that clean coal technology is a great big fraud upon the American people, because when you get coal from a mountaintop removal job, no matter what you do to it afterward, it can never be clean by virtue of the very means by which it was produced. So. But see, that's the thing. Both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, Hillary yesterday and Barack today, have referenced this clean coal technology fraud. Was Jay Rockefeller there with him?
What's the answer? Yes, of course he was. Him and his wife both gave him a wonderful introduction, and they're really excited about him running the country. Both of them were tremendous. I'd never heard Mr. Rockefeller speak before. And especially not his wife, and I was amazed. I guess I've just been out of the loop as far as getting to see him speak, but I was amazed at how behind Barack Obama. I was actually amazed that a lot of people were behind Barack Obama, because I thought that I was alone in this intelligence war. But I was amazed at how many people are 100% behind Barack Obama.
I want to be clear about this. Did he say, with no reservations, that mountaintop removal is wrong?
Yes.
Okay, can you try to search your mind and try to dredge up a paraphrase or whatever? How did that come about? This is very, very important.
Well, okay, a guy had stood, the guy who asked the question, that wasn't the question part. We were still in the speech. Now, in the speech, he did not mention mountaintop removal at all. He talked about a coal town that was in Illinois. Where he grew, where he grew up, and that was in the speech, and that was about the coal side. Now, when we went to questions, there were a lot of questions throughout the whole area, and most of them were ridiculous questions that made no sense, and most of them were questions that shouldn't have been asked in Beckley. I think a lot of Beckley's issues should have been addressed, and none of Beckley's issues were addressed at all. But nevertheless, he still addressed the coal issue with a guy who had stood up, and he was actually getting a lot of pop from the crowd. So it was difficult to hear everything that was going on at that point. But he did ask about mountaintop removal, and was talking about mountaintop removal being a major issue in the area, but he was also talking about a cigarette tax that made no sense at the same exact time, which made his question very vague. But Barack Obama did say that he was against mountaintop removal and got a big pop from the crowd from it.
Okay. Well, that's very, that.
As far as paraphrasing exactly, you know, the exact words that he said, that I mean, the atmosphere was so electric that the things you heard caused such an uproar of the people that it was hard to make out exact words. You know what I mean?
Well, what really did set him off? I mean, was it Iraq? Was it coal? Was it energy policy? Was it the possibility of $5 a gallon gas? I mean.
Are you talking about what set off the crowd?
Yeah, what lit the crowd up?
Every single thing he said. Everything. It was the most electric atmosphere I've ever been a part of.
Like a rock and roll show.
Not necessarily like a rock and roll show, because a rock and roll show would have a bunch of kids at it. This did not have a bunch of kids. This had a unity of people. This was like a gathering of people that are dying for change together as one, all kinds, all types, all stereotypes, all whatever you could call yourself, you could feel comfortable going there because it was a complete diverse crowd.
How long did the event last?
Oh, we were there forever, man. We showed up at 3:30. We were in line till probably 4:30, maybe even 4:45. We got inside, and it took like his music selection was brilliant. The music selection that played while you were seated. I mean, the whole thing was put together for everyone to feel the same common vibe. I mean, you had Tom Petty. There's nothing more American than Tom Petty, especially with "I Won't Back Down." Having "I Won't Back Down" play before, you know, before he came out, just kind of pumped up the nation. Have you heard John Mayer's "Waiting on the World to Change"?
Oh yeah, 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 yeah.
Tremendous song.
By the way, for the folks listening, if you haven't figured it out yet, Brian's a jock too. What music gets played matters to us. You can't get a DJ very far from his music.
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, the problem is it should matter to you. It should matter to you because that music really puts out a message that's going to capture these young people that are going to help you win the election. If you want to win the election, and I want to win the election, and all of us want to win the election, we've got to reach out to everybody, not just people that are into one side of it. You know what I mean? If you can reach someone with music and tell them they need to change the world, then yeah, it should be embraced by everyone that feels that way. Anyone with that ideology, anybody with that belief, should be behind that music. And there's, I mean, I don't know why you wouldn't care. Because it matters, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does.
It does.
Yeah. Well, you know.
And they played Counting Crows, the paved paradise, and put up a parking lot. And that's exactly what, you know, Bush and his system is doing to America. We're paving paradise and putting up parking lots. That's exactly what we're doing in a sense.
And flattening mountains. Yeah. Hey, B, I got a blinking light here, but I'm glad you went. I'm glad you're fired up, and I'm glad you decided to share the information with us, because I've been sitting here dying to find out what he said. Because you know, journalism around here don't pass for much.
He talked about a lot of things, and gas prices really, of course, got the crowd hardcore, and the war, of course, is a big issue, and the fact that we're $600 trillion, you know, in the hole over this thing.
Yeah, $3 trillion war. Yeah, $600 billion down the road. Yeah,
it's just ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Our deficit is in the trillions, and it's just. I mean, it's ridiculous what's going on, and we need someone smart running our country. That's what I totally believe. And actually, I'm going to write a blog about it, and if you do not mind, I would like to possibly give your listeners the option to check it out.
Oh, sure.
MySpace.com/B to the R to the E to the Z.
Is that numerals, letters, or...
No, it's just the word. B-T-O-T-H-E to the R to the E to the Z, all the way.
Okay, cool. Wonderful, wonderful. Well, B, I'm glad you called in, and, you know, don't be such a stranger. Wander in anytime.
Hey, I will not, because we need to talk. We definitely need to talk on a major level a lot. I mean, I want to be on the show a lot. I want to call in a lot.
Any time the spirit moves you, my brother.
Well, I'll tell you what. One of these days I'm going to call and I'm going to have a conversation about Ron Paul, because I really hate Ron Paul, and I want to tell you why.
Oh, good, because we do too.
Oh, man, I hate him with a passion, and I think he's a poison, and I'd really like to share it with you one day. I'll call you back.
All right. Thanks, B.
Have a good day, Bob.
Later, man.
Bye.
Bye. Our buddy Brian Reznor, the announcer for this program. Let's see if you stayed with me. Yeah, you did. Hi, who have I got?
Hi, is it me?
It's you.
Okay, this is Carla.
Hey, Carla, how you doing?
I'm fine. Can't always tell when I'm on the air. A couple of things. I'm listening to Barack Obama. Now it's being rebroadcast on C-SPAN. And it was only what we saw. We saw a brief introduction by Senator Rockefeller, and then Obama spoke. But he didn't speak very long, and it wasn't a typical, you know, some of the Trump speech. He did address Senator McCain and his, like getting, if you vote for McCain, you're going to get another Bush policy. It's just a continuation. He got a big applause for that. On education, salaries, and he was tying the cost of the war into what we're not getting done here in the United States. He addressed, China, where they're our debt holder. We're borrowing money from China, and he's more or less said that something's wrong with this picture. But they didn't show any of the question and answer period, so I don't know if, that's all I'm going to say on that, but I liked it because it was different and he was addressing problems and then most importantly tying the cost of the war into what we're not getting done here, with things that could be done in West Virginia, and other states, or infrastructure that's going down, so that's it. But one thing I wanted to I watched the other night, and I only saw about 10 minutes of it or five,
mm-hmm.
because I couldn't stomach it. And they never repeated it that I could see. They had, I guess in Washington, D.C., a talk show, radio seminar that they have annually, and George Stephanopoulos was the...
That was the Radio and Records Washington Conference.
Oh, okay.
Mark Levine was there.
Who?
Mark Levine.
Oh, well, he was. I didn't see him on the panel.
No. They don't do that with...
The progressive liberals.
Yeah, progressives and liberals are not welcome.
Well, they had on the panel that I did see, they had some guy, from the right, from New York, very vicious. I think his name was Rotberg, Hallberg, and of course, old Neil Borsch. And then another guy who was just as hateful, and then Big Eddie, Al Sharpton, and a woman was on there, and I think she was there for the comedy. Stephanie Miller.
Yeah. Stephanie's always good for a laugh.
I mean, she—that's all she is a comedian. She didn't. All of her comments were digs and snide remarks about.
Yeah, she's a funny lady. She's not there for substance or depth. Substance is not her shtick.
She's just there for, keep people.
She's there for the one-liners, the snappers.
I didn't like her at all. I want substance. I want, issues being discussed.
Right.
And of course, they could only concentrate, the right couldn't only concentrate on hatefulness and all of that.
That's all they've got.
Yep. And then the other thing, you know, we talked about, you know, Jeremiah Wright and Obama's speech. But the day before, Hillary had another one of her presidential Iraq policy speech. And all she kept saying, when I'm president, when I'm president. But if you listen to her tone and Obama's tone, you know, on the race, Obama came off a lot more presidential than Hillary could. And, you know, and he...
And I think he always will, Carla, because that's not the kind of... And this is no slur. That's not the kind of person that Hillary Clinton is. Hillary Clinton is the kind of person who got through law school and was number one in her class because you couldn't pull her out of the books. Hillary is a scholar, a student of public policy and of government and of good governance, and so she's never going to come across with that magnetism or charisma or charm, and I think that's what's doing her in when she's compared to Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Because Obama is just a thousand times better in front of a crowd than she is. And it's got to drive her handlers crazy because Obama is the way Bill Clinton was in 1992. He can create in an audience the sense that he is identifying with them. There's an old trick in public speaking where if you want people to think that you're looking right at them, first of all, you never make eye contact in a speech. But you can make the audience think that you are by looking at, by picking a spot about 6 inches over the crowd's head. And every place you look, they'll think you're looking right at them.
Mm-hmm.
And you can thereby create that familiarity and that connection. Hillary Clinton simply can't do that.
Yeah, because she has to read from the notes.
She goes from the notes. That's kind of a pity because I've heard from a lot of people who have spoken with her and met with her one-on-one that she is absolutely engaging, that she is personable, that she is pleasant when she's dealing with people one-on-one, but she cannot translate that to a crowd. On the other hand, Senator Obama can and does because he has been schooled on it. I got an email earlier today pointing out the fact that Obama more or less grew up without much of a father figure, and that Jeremiah Wright is that surrogate father, and he has learned oratory skills from Jeremiah Wright. He has learned turns of phrase. He has learned how to work a crowd. I mean, you want to learn how to work a crowd, talking to a minister is not the worst place to start.
That's true.
And so he can master that oratory, and he can deliver that personable style that, frankly, Senator Clinton simply can't.
Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting. I finally got to get to a bookstore that had Obama's first book, Dreams from My Father.
Right.
And it is an excellent book. It brought tears to my eyes, you know, and it talked about his relationship with his maternal grandfather and his mother, and then, you know, the fact that his, you know, mother married an Indonesian, went over there, and he was schooled in two different schools, and, you know, one was Catholic and one was a Muslim school, because that's all they had to...
Right, that's what was there.
That was for every little kid, and she could see, you know, a difference in her second husband because they went over there when Indonesia was going through a turmoil. And she also schooled him through correspondence school because they couldn't afford to go to the money that where she taught, you know, for the generals and, you know, at the embassy. And then she decided, and then she brought her son back to Hawaii with her daughter. And she was going back, and he said, no, I want to live here with grandfather, you know, and his grandmother. So she let him do that. But his father left him when he was two and, you know, went to Harvard. And his father was a Phi Beta Kappa graduate and went to Kenya and had problems there because of the different tribes. And he was like a lot of what I would say white people go through sometimes here, where you're very skilled, but for some reason they don't want you in the job, so they'll bring in somebody else, and then you've got to train them because you make them more educated and more knowledgeable, but they don't, you know, like you, and then they get rid of you because they say you're a rebel rouser. But his mother kept in contact with the father and would send, you know, progress reports on Obama, you know. But yeah, he, you know, basically, you know, his grandfather had, you know, issues of unfulfilled dreams himself. And so it's a very touching, you know, story. And then he talks about when he goes over there to Kenya and meets the whole family, and, you know, and after they called him about his father's death. It's just a very moving story.
I'm gonna try to read some of it. Hey, Carla, I need to run along. I've just found out that Mark Levine is on the line with us, and he's got some breaking news that I think might be quite interesting to all of us. I'm sorry to cut this short, but I want to make sure that the news gets out, okay?
Okay.
Thank you, Carla.
All righty.
Bye now. Have a good evening.
Uh-huh.
Bye.
You got me now, Bob.
I got you, Mark. We've got the Bush's Watergate. They finally come to their Waterloo.
This could be it. This could be it. They just announced it just a few minutes ago. Obama's passport file has been illegally and improperly accessed now three times, starting January 9th, and the latest is just last Friday. And apparently, now the claim will be, and there's going to be a huge press conference in 45 minutes, but or talk to the press. I'm not sure. The State Department is going to say something in 30 minutes. But the idea is that some State Department officials on three separate occasions have been looking into his passport files, which, of course, is illegal. Those are private files, and they've already admitted that they had no reason to do so. Now, the way they found out was that a low-level State Department official, just the office, called Obama's Senate office, not even his campaign office, and just sort of told him matter-of-factly, oh, by the way, you know, we've caught some people looking into your passport file, and, you know, a couple of them have been fired, and one of them has been reprimanded. And they sort of told him nonchalant. The Obama campaign, of course, came out firing, said, what are you talking about? This is amazing. And here's the thing. If they were all low-level employees just playing around...
Well, what I'm seeing here, Mark, is that they are actually more of those ubiquitous Bush administration contractors.
Well, they were contractors. We already know they were contract employees. This is what makes the thing look so much like Watergate. Because in Watergate, we still don't know to this day. Some say Nixon ordered it. Some say Nixon didn't order it. We still don't know. That could be an 18-and-a-half-minute gap on the tapes. But what we know from Watergate is that it happened, and then the cover-up went all the way up to the president. In this case, it happened on three separate occasions. If it was just one guy fooling around, they would have found out, they would have fired him, and they would have notified Obama immediately. I could imagine Condoleezza Rice giving Obama a call and saying, we caught it, it was last weekend, it was just some low-level person, and he's fired. But the fact that it took right now more than 2 months lets me know that this thing must have gone way up to the highest breaches of the Bush administration. And if we can prove a cover-up, this is really serious stuff.
Isn't it interesting that this develops in the context of the court order from last week, Mark? I'm sure you caught this.
That's right. That said the Bush administration had to turn over their emails.
Yeah, and that they had to back them up. The court wanted affirmative proof of backups of all emails, and the emails in question would fall under this particular time frame.
Are you sure about the time frame?
Yes.
I'm not sure about that.
Yes, I'm certain of it.
Okay, all right, because I didn't remember the time
frame. Because it was dealing with recent emails.
The other thing that's interesting, of course, is January 9th. The Iowa caucus was January 3rd, all right? Maybe they didn't think Barack Obama was a real threat. Hillary Clinton was going to take it away. He wins the Iowa caucus January 3rd, and lo and behold, January 9th, they're going into his passport file. Just when he's a threat. Just when it looks, and of course, Obama is not like most presidential candidates. This is a guy who's traveled a lot. As a child, he lived in Indonesia for 4 years.
Well, and that's another thing. You know, the Hillary Clinton campaign was dinged for releasing the photograph of Obama in Kenya, right? Remember?
We don't know that it was Hillary Clinton that did it.
We don't. Matt Drudge didn't even say that it was, but she was dinged for it. But the one word that was used in regard to that bit of sleaze was Rovian.
Right, right. No, I think it is.
So this also falls within that time frame as well.
Yes, yes. This is exactly the games that Rove plays. This is exactly like he does it. And the question is, will we be able to prove it? Now, in 1992, George Bush Sr. did that to Bill Clinton's passport files, and a special prosecutor was appointed to look into it. And obviously they're going to have to at least appoint a special prosecutor here.
But the special prosecutor law has expired.
Well,
that special prosecutor was appointed as a appointed as a function of the special prosecutor law, which compelled it. That law does not exist anymore.
If he refuses to do so, I see impeachment on the table. I mean, I really think if he refuses to appoint a special prosecutor in this case, I don't know how they could not bring impeachment proceedings.
I don't either. But it has to, you know, there has to be a willingness, of course, you know that. And John Conyers said,
this changes everything, Bob. This, you know, it's weird. You can lie about getting into war. You can torture people. You can, put people in jail without trial. And American people don't notice. It takes something very specific like this, like Watergate, to make the people step up and notice. Now, again, we don't know what happened. It could be these were all low-level employees.
Bull.
Who knows? But it happened on three separate occasions. That's what gets me, right?
Yeah.
Three, and apparently, the first two were fired, and the last guy was reprimanded. How did this thing keep happening? My guess is someone told them to do this. Now, again, we don't know all the facts yet. But if you threaten to criminally charge some people, then that's when they start squealing on their higher ups.
And I'm not trying to throw any cold water here, but of course this would all fall under the jurisdiction of the Justice Department,
unless they appoint a prosecutor. Now, you know, of course, in the Libya affair, they did appoint a special prosecutor, Fitzgerald, after Americans got very angry and demanded it. Again, we don't know all the facts yet. We're probably going to find out more tonight. But this is something where we all have to demand that Congress demand that they appoint a special prosecutor right away. This is serious stuff. This is, the Democratic probable nominee, and the timing is very, very suspicious.
But beyond a special prosecutor, it also demands prompt action from the Congress itself, does it not?
Yeah, well, yes, it does. I mean, the problem is...
I mean, we don't have to wait, Mark, we don't have to wait for a special prosecutor
for Henry Waxman
to jump on it, or Conyers.
Henry Waxman will be issuing subpoenas, I suspect, by Monday morning. I have a big fan of Henry Waxman. The problem is, and this goes back to the contempt stuff I was arguing earlier, the problem is that the administration has simply been refusing to obey subpoenas. But if this gets enough press, and I think it has to, the American people they may not care much about Harriet Myers and Josh Bolton, and yet the irony is what Harriet Myers and Josh Bolton are in trouble for is politicizing the Justice Department.
Yes.
And that's exactly, well, this seems to be the State Department, but that's exactly what's going on here.
This is Condoleezza Rice's State Department.
Well, and also, it all goes back to how did they find Spitzer? They were going through, looking through bank records that were his private records. There was no indication he'd done any crime, and they were looking to take him down. They went after Don Siegelman in Alabama. What we see is that this is an administration, I saw a statistic recently, that has looked after, I think it was 23 Democrats to one Republican. This is an administration that has been using justice as a sword for many years now. It's only coming clean. That's why it was so important for the Bush administration to get retroactive amnesty for all the spying they're doing.
Precisely.
They're not spying on Al-Qaeda. They're spying on us.
They know every time that Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama has gone to the bathroom, and you and I both know it, Mark.
That's right. That's exactly right. They're doing what J. Edgar Hoover did to Martin Luther King.
And it's also you know, where Spitzer's concerned, it's also noteworthy that on February 14th in the Washington Post, he delivered an excoriating, scathing editorial regarding mis and malfeasance on Wall Street.
bang.
Well, exactly. Exactly. Well, I mean, he was going after the most powerful Republicans in the country. Spitzer was a very powerful man, and obviously he shouldn't have done what he did, but this is, again, what they did to Bill Clinton. I mean, this is not news. They couldn't beat Bill Clinton on politics. He had prosperity. We had peace. And so he went. He knew that Bill Clinton liked to sleep around. So that, you know, people have faults.
And they
didn't find anything. They just had to make up stuff because Siegelman apparently, you know, didn't do anything wrong.
Right. And in this case, they're doing the same. They probably were doing the same thing they did to Bill Clinton. That was because it was after they went snooping in his passport file that the business came. Well, he went to the Soviet Union and denounced America.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And went to Great Britain. That's where the whole I didn't inhale thing came from.
Yep.
They were looking in what he did in Britain. Look, I'm sure they are looking for everything for Obama, and I sure hope to God Obama does not have a speeding ticket because they'll find it. But they're going to be looking. Here's what they're going to do. They're going to find that Obama went to, I don't know, some country. He went to Indonesia. We know that. Maybe he went to Pakistan. Who knows? With his mother, and they're going to say he met with Al-Qaeda. Who knows what they're going to do? They're snooping. They probably found nothing. But the fact that they're snooping is exactly the kind of thing that they did in Watergate. You know,
this is a
thing either.
And again, we got to do it bumper sticker style. This is a crime.
Yes, this is a crime. No question, this is a crime.
And they
anyway,
can't walk away.
I don't
away
know where this is all going to go, but I knew I wanted to call in and let Horn listeners know right away.
Well, thank you, Mark. And I'll try to have the lowdown on it by tomorrow evening.
Yeah, yeah.
And
you know,
I'm sure
Elo asked me to call back during the Horn section, and I'll do that, and that'll give you, Bob, a chance to take a look as well. As usually, Keith Olbermann appears to be the first to have reported it, and he is all over the story. You even had Andrea Mitchell. Now, she, as many know, is the wife of Alan Greenspan. She's a Republican. She's no fan. She's the one who's been knocking the Democrats the whole time. Even she, they called her on an airplane and said this is extraordinary and this is severe. And, you know, this is big stuff.
It is. This is the kind of stuff that brings down castles.
This is the kind of stuff that can finally bring down a president. It's actually very similar to Watergate. It's spying on your political opponents. Remember, Nixon, they never proved Nixon ordered Watergate. All they proved was that he covered it up. They don't have to prove that Bush ordered this or that Rove ordered this. But it's now been 2 months, 2.5 months since the first one. All they have to prove is a cover-up, and it's exactly like Watergate. We have an exact historical parallel. Big stuff.
Exactly. Well, get back with us on the section, will you, Mark?
I will get back on the section, absolutely.
All right.
I'm going to go back and watch more of it now.
Please do. Please do. I'll be producing, so I won't be so in the loop. You got to do the loop thing.
I'll be back during the Horn section.
All right, sounds good. Thanks,
all right,
Mark.
Let me read to you Obama's statement, just so you have it here. Hold on. I got it right here. Obama has said, quote, this is an outrageous breach of security and privacy, even from an administration that has shown little regard for either over the last 8 years. Our government's duty is to protect the private information of the American people, not use it for political purposes. This is a serious matter that merits a complete investigation, and we demand to know who looked at Senator Obama's passport file, for what purpose, and why it took so long for them to reveal this security breach. Pretty strong statement.
Good stuff. Good stuff.
All right. I'll be back on at the Horn time.
Okay. Thanks, Mark.
Sure.
Bye now.
Bye.
Mark Levine does not miss a lick. Thanks, everybody, for a wonderful evening and for sharing your time with me, with us. Coming up next, a brand spanking new Strictly Confidential with the world's most fabulous LGBT conversation radio host, Peter Godbold, who is also our IT professional. Thanks to John Fox, our chief engineer, and to Ben Birch, who makes the stream do all the things that the stream does that means enough to you to allow you to tune in every night. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. Be part of the solution. Join Coal River Mountain Watch. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.
the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the Dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to book, chapter, and verse 128 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio, exclusively right here on the listener-supported Head-On Radio Network, also brought to you in part by Coal River Mountain Watch. That's Coal River Mountain Watch at crmw.net. Stop by crmw.net and have a look at what mountaintop removal is doing to West Virginia. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Indeed, today is a Thursday, and it is March the 20th, 2008. So if you're listening shortly after 9 p.m. Eastern Time on the Thursday evening, March 20, 2008, you're indeed listening to a live show, and you are more than welcome to call in and chat with me and just anybody else that happens to show up. The toll-free lines are 877, the number 4, head-on. That translates into 877-443-2366. The toll line, if you happen to have unlimited long distance, is area code 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333, and that rings in West Virginia. And the phone will be answered by Agnes or Bob. Email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com. That's Peter at headonradionetwork.com. And I do try to check the email during the breaks. Also, the chat room is active if you choose to participate that way. It's a good evening to stop by the chat room. There are lots of folks there and lots of activity. It's always a great pleasure to be involved in the Head On Radio Network chat room, which is active during all of the program. Our show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and there you're going to find links to all of the guests, as well as to the guests' audio archives and archives for our Just Us segments of Strictly Confidential from all the past shows. You'll find links there to the chat room. You'll find links to the Head On Radio Network main site, where you can find out about all the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network, of which I'm only a small part, and you will also find the PayPal button there to help us keep the packets passing and the servers serving and the cassettes rolling and the DVDs spinning and the CDs ramping up and the fans and the microprocessors whirring. Yes, indeed, it costs money to keep this network going. Nonetheless, we're here every evening. You'll find links there at strictlyconfidentialradio.com for the MySpace page.